All right, I think we'll call the committee to order. I think we have a quorum here, and so, Rookavina, you'd like to move your bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could maybe just quiet the crowd down here.
Quiet down, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Sir, I move House Bill 60 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Finance Committee. And members, if you indulge me, I'll do a quick walkthrough and hit the high points. I intend, Mr. Chair, after my presentation, to, if we have any time left, to answer questions from the committee members, to take comments from the audience, questions from the audience, and then hopefully reconvene this evening and start to go through the bill as far as amendments or anything that we may need to have. Mr. Berg, maybe you could come up and sit with me. You're much better at numbers than I am. So, members, you can see the appropriations for higher education on page one. And the Office of Higher Education, I tried not to to cut their general fund funding as far as, or like the governor cut the office a little bit. The tuition increase for four-year programs under state grants on page two, you can see I increased the four-year maximum cap by $100. I increased the living and miscellaneous expenses by $700. Going on to page three, I increased the state work study program by $6.1 million, child care grants by $1.6
million, Mr. Chair.
And the Indian scholarship by $1 million. On the bottom of the page, I restored some of the governor's cuts in Minitex, Minlink, and Learning Network. On page four, Mr. Chair, I...
Representative Anderson has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Rookavina, I know you wanted to get to this quickly, but I was hoping you could review a little bit. Again, the increases that you've got on here, starting back with the St. Grant portion on page two, you were talking about... I think it's a living allowance. I'd like to be able to have a chance to write some of these down, and you were just going too quickly for me, if you could, please.
I'm sorry. Representative Anderson, if you look on the spreadsheet, I don't know if it would break it down by individuals, but the numbers, it does.
Does not.
Line 33 there, you'll see on the state grant changes, line 30.
Oh.
Line 31, 32. 33 is basically, I'm going off the main bill, but I think you can pretty much follow it on the spreadsheet.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, yes. Particularly in the case of the state grant program, you'll see numbers repeated, for instance, so there, the numbering, there's a gap there ahead of them, but what would be line 30 right below, the gap below line 29, you see the governor's LME increase, and then lower down at what's labeled line 30. Line 33 is the House's LME increase, because we both do the same thing but at different levels. So, labels one is the governor's, and then you can see what column they're in. But we use the same basic levers there in the program, just a different amount.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. On page four, Keith's program representative buys bill, I believe that I think that's less than the appropriation was, or is it exactly the same?
A little bit less.
A little less than, more. Power of You, I kept the current program and increased the pilot program for two sites in suburban and rural Minnesota. There's an emergency grant line you see on page 4, line 4.13 and 4.14. During the last recession in the 80s, it was a small contingency fund for extraordinary economic circumstances for students, say if a car broke down or whatever, that they could fix it. Line 4.24 is the OTREMBA bill for the Veterinary Loan Forgiveness Program. Moving on, there's some new language on line 5.19 to 5.23 regarding resident physician program in rural Minnesota. Line on page 6, members, the central office, we're getting into the MINSCU part of the budget. There's a reduction in the central office of approximately $4 million, I believe. There are also some, there's language from line 7.5 to 7.10 to try to protect the campuses, individual campus bases that, having been on Easter break, it's not as tough as I'd like it to be, but I'm going to try to fix that up later. There's a requirement on the Board of Trustees to submit a plan for reduction in the next biennium, and knowing what will happen in the next biennium, and if when there's no federal stimulus money, and there's also language in here that directs the money to try to make cuts. Not to the instruction part of higher education, but towards administration and management type programs. Let's see, continuing on page 8, there's a few more cuts on the awards of excellence and technology to the central office. I have a technology cap in there on lines 8.13 to 8.19 regarding technology spending, and there's the regular appropriation of Cook County, the language that was in the bill 2 years ago to the NEHED vocational program in eFolio, and then there's the stimulus money, the actual numbers in there from the stimulus package, which I believe that the same amount of money as the governor allocated to both systems, if I'm not mistaken. I have a tuition cap built in for the MINSCU system on page 10. 5% a year with a proposal to buy that down to 2% with each year with the stimulus money. The language on page 10.16 to 10.25 is Representative Detmer's human resource language on this bill. Getting into the University of Minnesota, we've got language on the top of page 11 on administrative increases and salaries to not allow that to happen. Hopefully, I've got on page 11, excuse me, line 11.12, 11.14 represents Junkies Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory that we heard the other day, appropriation in there. The page 11, the bottom of page 11 through 12, 13 is Representative Welty's language regarding all the ag specials. Representative Norton's language regarding the Mayo Foundation partnership is on page 15. That's House File 552, 15.14 to 15.31. And then there's the federal stimulus appropriation dollar amount at the bottom of the page. On page 16 is the new middle class scholarship that the university proposed. They lowered the income amount a little bit from 2 years ago when they requested this program from $150,000 of income to $100,000 to reach more students. There's language that the university have a tuition cap on the top of page 17. that the net increase for Minnesota resident undergraduate students shall not exceed $300 a year for the biennium. And there's language, new language on the NRI Research Institute on directing some royalty payment, money that they get to try to give some laid off mining, metallurgical, mechanical engineers in the mining industry some hands-on experience at the research lab in Coleraine. There is language on the bottom of the page trying to increase resident enrollment at the University of Minnesota. I've had some complaints about very good students not getting enrolled, and I'm sure others have had those too. The medical school language on page 18 I think is the same, and I didn't cut the governor cut that appropriation, and I didn't. In Article 2, that's House File 1281, Conan language on page 18. Page 19 is Representative Kahn, and I believe is Representative Reiner. No, that's Representative Kahn's bill on the, excuse me, on House File 817 on elections and at Minsky campuses. On page 20, I've got Made in America clothing thing I put in there from myself. On page 21 is these, I think, are all governor language at the top that was in Representative Norris's House File 2087. And I think that all of this language may be Representative Norris's also. On the top of page 22, Representative Atkins, House File 1560, reduces on the state grant program the student share to 45%, which I think is fair across the board to all the different Minnesota residents, whether public or private institutions. Lines 22.11 to 22.20 give a fifth year of eligibility for the state grant program, which I believe has a fiscal cost of $16 million. I'm looking at, yeah. About 12 to 16 million, my fiscal analyst tells me. There is a cap on the two-year private colleges based on the largest tuition fee at tuition and fee amount charged at a Minnesota two-year institution, the Minnesota's two-year institution. The language on the top of 23 is in Representative Norris's bill, House File 2087, the governor's proposal. That's all the way to the bottom of the page. Representative Otremba's language then on the veterinary loan program is on the bottom of the page, continuing through, I believe, 25.23, where I've got language to have the Board of Trustees elected like the Board of Regents by a joint convention of the legislature. And so that's all that language through 26. And I believe Representative Fiskin's language is on the bottom of page 27 regarding the tuition guarantee. And I think, Ms. Fine, this is both for Minsky and the university, and she's not here. Ms. Novak? It's for both, right?
Mr. Chair, there's two separate sections, one for the university and one for Minsky.
But dealing with the Biskin bill.
Correct.
On line, page 28 is some language on the Board of Regents selection. The language on page 29 that's deleted is a change requested by the university for all their payments flow from the Department of Finance. There's more language there on section 23 from Representative Bissonville. The bottom of the page is a reduction in the biomedical projects at the University of Minnesota on the number of projects they got in the bonding bill last year, which frees up some money for bonding. Now on page 31 is Representative Pond, House Bill dealing with University of Minnesota, Minneapolis neighborhood environment around the campus, and Representative Reiner's language that was amended to that. Let's see, on page 33 is more language dealing with the election bill of Representative Pond, House Bill 817, which goes continues through page 36, I believe. The language in section 36 just moves that fifth year grant program to eligible peace officer survivors so that they qualify for 10 semesters also. Page, the bottom of the page, 37 to the top of the page, on 38 is dealing with the a stadium issue where the Board of Regents allows everybody to drink or nobody to drink, I guess is the way to put it. Language in section 38 is in Representative Nornes' bill that he carried for the governor, House Bill 2087. The language in 39 was needed when Winona, I think, bonded when they were at tech school, paid for by the school district, allowed them to keep the money from the sale of that facility, I believe. Instead of, normally it would be turned over to finance, but this was paid for by local taxes, so it would be kept locally. The section 40 deals with the 6120 credit language that I believe was supported by the College Faculty and Students Association, if I'm not mistaken. The pilot program Representative Carlson had wanted are described in section 41, and so members, that's the higher ed part of the bill. If there are any questions from members, or if you want me to just continue, Mr. Chair. So then I'll just continue on with the workforce development part of the bill. I believe in your spreadsheet you'll see I cut D's, I think almost maybe just a little more or less, a little less, $620,000 less on general fund money than the governor did. Yeah, $8.1 million cut in total. Representative Gunther's bill is on page 41. From the governor's bill, House Bill 1669 on the remediation fund for contamination cleanup. Representative Morrow's bill restoring some of the money to the Minnesota, to the Rural Policy and Development Center in St. Peter. House Bill 821, I believe, is $100,000 a year less than they received the last biennium. The language on page 42, on line 42.9, is Representative Mullery's Women Venture language. It's down $25,000 annually than it was 2 years ago. Representative Clark's House File 1153 is on line 42.26. where I believe is a small cut over the last 2 years, $50,000. Representative Torkelson's bill, 1587, is on the top of page 43 for the Minnesota Investors, Inventors Congress. And Representative Winkler and Mahoney's bill is on 43.5. I think it's exactly what the governor recommended for that program. Representative Torkelson's bill is less than what the Inventors Congress got, but I think the program was zeroed out by the governor. It's 35,000 less each year than last year. Representative Detmer's bill, House Bill 16 for Hugo, is there on page 44 at the top of the page. There was also a request by Representative Steele that came in last week as they're putting this bill together from Lake County, where they had a huge ice storm a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. That leveled basically 12 townships, 12 full townships, and snapped off all the Popple and Aspen trees that were in there for funding for them. Lines 44.10 through 44.17 is an initiative by myself for the 21st Century Mineral Funds that were just recently deposited at deed for an engineering program for an expansion of classrooms and that needed for that program up on the range. Representative Gunther's language is on 44.18 to 44.25, dealing with House File 1905 for entrepreneur and small business programs in some of the counties in southern Minnesota. Workforce development money on page 45 on the $4,562,000 for job skill partnership is the same as the governor's. I used stimulus money for the next for B, C, and D to, I believe, restore or maybe increase a little bit above the 07 levels where we're trying to use stimulus money from the federal government. Representative, I believe on the bottom of the page is Representative Mahoney's language and money from House File 939 regarding RISE, Twin City RISE. Representative Lanning's House File restores on line page 46, line 46.4 to 46.11. The Purim, dollars for Purim's Workforce Development Fund. And I think the governor zeroed it out, and or the governor cut it 100 a year, and I restored 50,000 each year. The Brainerd language on House Bill 1941 is page is on 46.17 through 46.27. Also House Bill 848 Brainerd on the bottom of the page. The governor had cut 40,000 a year, and we want DC stimulus money to restore that cut. The language on 47.5 through 47.12, the governor, I believe this is Representative Gunther's language, exactly as the governor recommended it. I think it's a $5,000 cut the first year, or $5,000 both years each year. Five general fund and $10,000 cut in workforce development money. Representative Powell's language is House Bill 915 on line 47.13 is the same, I believe, as the governor proposed it. Representative Haas, House Bill 1901 is next. The $3.5 million is the base appropriation, I believe, the same as 2 years ago. Representative Slocum's House Bill 1207 restores the cut to the OICs. Representative Mullery's bill, House Bill 1045, restores $250,000 of the $325,000 cut that the governor made in the Minneapolis Summer Youth Program, Learn to Earn. Representative Gunther's language is the same as the governor on 48.7. Representative Clark's youth bill is on House Bill 1645 on line 48.15, and Representative Clark's House Bill 2071 on Indigenous Youth Indian Program is a new $100,000 a year appropriation for that program. On page 49, Representative Gunther
House Law 1669 is the same as the governor's. Representative Johnson's House Law 315 is on the bottom of that page. I believe that program was in our bill in a bigger amount 2 years ago and was vetoed. It may have been $150,000 a year, I think it was back then. Representative Thiessen's House Law 785 is at the top of page 50. Representative Hawes, House Law 1104, which the governor zeroed out, is restored half, and we expect that restored half with workforce development money, and we expect the department to restore the remainder with stimulus package. House Law 744 is the next one on line 50.24. That's the Mullery bill that we heard dealing with Southeast Asian Collaborative. It's $100,000 of new money, and it requires a one-to-one match. Page 51.16 is a pilot program on the MEAD bill that I presented, House Law 1326. And Representative, I believe, Mahoney on line 51.33 is for Enterprise Minnesota, $750,000 for the biennium, which I think is the same as 2 years ago. And then at the end of that deed language on page 52 is House Bill 1666, Representative Hayden's bill on $150,000 each year for the demonstration project for the high-risk adult program that we heard late last week. And members, that's the deed portion in the Department of Labor and Industry. Representative Norton's House File 1694 is on page 53 for the Vinland Center. I believe it's the same as 2 years ago. There was an appropriation in the governor's bill for from the Workforce Development Fund for an apprenticeship program, and I took some of his money for the prevailing wage enforcement for, I believe, Ms. Newman 2 proposed layoffs, or three layoffs. The language on the bottom of page 53 is new language. Representative Nelson and I think Mahoney were dealing with the issue of the independent contractors, and because the dollars didn't come in last biennium like they expected on those registrations, there were some layoffs to that program, and so we used assigned risk money, $200,000 each year to keep those, I believe, two positions. And the Bureau of Mediation Services on page 54 is the governor's recommendation, and the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals is the current base. The Board of Accountancy is the governor's rec. The Board of Architecture is the governor's rec. The Board of Barbers and Cosmetology, and well, we'll have a discussion on that whole issue later, I guess. And the combative sports, I gave an appropriation to keep them going for the time being at least, and I would hope that the state agencies, be it the Department of Finance or maybe Deed, can help them find space to help them through their lean times. Page 55 then is Mahoney language to page 58 dealing with the St. Paul River Center's forgiveness on the loan and 4 years out for the bill that we heard regarding a new practice site for the wild and for other ice related programs. Article 4 and page 58 is Sections 1 and 3 are Representative Dabney's bill. It's a housekeeping bill for deeds through page 50. The language on page 60 is basically the same language that other agencies have regarding federal dollars being spent. That deed currently doesn't have the same type of statutory language. And Representative Solberg has suggested more Dabney language on page 61, that's the department, through page 62 and 63 and 64. This is all deed language. The language on the bottom of page 66 is language requested by Mr. Coleman on the grant program so that counties would be treated the same as cities. I believe that keeps going through page 67, maybe then that language then. And page 68 is Representative Dabney's housekeeping bill for deed again. Then there's more language in the middle of the page dealing with the Mr. Coleman's request on counties and cities for that grant program. On page 70, I brought that program back to the 50% being in rural Minnesota that it was 3 years ago. On page 71, section 15 and 16, I represent Gunther's bill that was in the governor's bill. House Bill 1569. On page 72 is Representative Norton's language from House Bill 1785 regarding the accountability requirement for grants at deed. Page 73 is Dabney language from the technical bill. On page 74, members, is an increase in the workforce development fee from the current 0.10 that I had hoped that and gave language in the bill 2 years ago for Commissioner McElroy to raise to 0.12, and times aren't good right now with displaced workers and everything else, so it goes up to 0.14 for 2 years and then back down to 0.12 in the next biennium. Section 21 is Representative Clark's language from House Bill 1645. And on the next page, in 75, sections 23 and 24 are from Representative Dabney's technical bill. I believe basically 277, except on page 77 is Representative Mahoney's language dealing with Mr. Till's program, so that larger businesses pay a little more of a match, I believe, than only, right? Which is that language through the bottom of the page. And then section 27 is more Dabney language from the technical bill to 78, 79, 80, 81, 82. Going 83 and 84 is still technical language. 85, 86. Yeah, Representative Dabney had a long bill for the department, so I think that basically goes through page 90. But even though on page 90 are changes in unemployment insurance that Mr. Nelson had, Mr. Lee Nelson had in the bill, there's some new language in there on allowability for keeping a 401k there that you could see. I believe that was in the Dabney bill too. All of this language continuing on through 91, 92, 93, 94, 95. Keep going and still on page 97. I'm in Article 6 now, which are still technical changes to unemployment insurance, and I believe they go all the way to page 127. If I'm not mistaken, I don't think anything else is in there, Ms. Newman. Am I correct? So, on page 127, then, our this language dealing with that I had a complaint on from some requirements to work more than 16 hours straight on heavy mining equipment that I put in the bill. And Article 8 is the entire House Bill 1669 from the Governor and Representative Gunther on all those fee increases, which I think raise about $900,000 or $800,000 annually after the first year, which is, Mr. Berg, about $6 or $7 million. Would you help me out on this?
Mr. Chairman, members, on page 5 of the spreadsheet, you'll see the very last set of boxes is non-general fund revenue, and it reflects those key changes. There's actually two categories, the biennial renewal, which is split in two funds, and then the building permit and plan review. The building permit is an increase in the fee. The other two is switching the schedule. And you see on the spreadsheet the amounts. So you get collectively $3.6 million in the first year and $900,000 a year, which is the increase in the building permit fee. And the governor's recommendations are the bill is the same as the governor's recommendations.
And so that would be Article 8, members, and then I think, I don't know, was that Representative Mahoney did do it? Have some language in there, too, or that he worked out, I think, or maybe that was all the Gunther bill. And then that goes through page 139, I think. There were some repealers on page 140 in law that I think Representative Pawlowski addressed that were set to sunset that he determined shouldn't sunset. Ms. Newman, is that correct? That we don't sunset them. And that goes on to page 141 then. It's House Bill 1699 at the bottom of the page is Representative Purcell's language regarding his attempt to salvage the three wood plants. And I believe this is new language that was worked out with him and the Senate author. On page 142 is the cosmetology fee increase. And then language, there's more language on page 143. Dealing with the expiration of different councils with Representative Pawlowski. There was some language on page 143 at the bottom requested by Commissioner Lehman at the IRRB to allow them to be part of a seabed project, being that they're not funded with the general fund dollars. There's more language on the page at the bottom of page 144. Dealing with those councils that expire under Representative Pawlowski's bill. And on page 145, there's technical language dealing with transfer of funds that I don't know if it's... Yeah, do you want to take over on that?
Mr. Chairman, this was also in the governor's bill. In the construction code consolidation bill of 2 years ago, there was, at the end of the day on that, the legislation said that there would be a transfer of funds from the construction code account to the general fund, and in perpetuity would basically a $1.5 million a year. The governor canceled that transfer. This bill does the exact same thing as the governor, and that is a general fund change that's on line 234 of the spreadsheet. Which is the third to last set of boxes that have general fund revenue changes. And it just eliminates that transfer. And
then Article 10 deals with Iron Range Resources. There's a number of changes in here requiring a majority of the board to spend money in different funds. It was just a quorum, and we didn't think that four people in some of these programs should be able to spend the money. There's an early retirement incentive in here that is similar to one offered in 2005 at IRRB. The other language on basically on 147, 148 deal with that seven-member issue on spending dollars. Section 6 and 7 were requested by the commissioner for some limited liability corporations, and then we had to change the, on where you see those townships referenced on 149, because the city of Boabic now is, the Giant Bridge area is in the city of Boabic and not the town of White anymore because of an annexation. In sections 8 through 13, again, deal with seven members of the board approving dollars, and I think that goes all the way to page 153, where there are a number of projects to try to get some get the economy going in the different districts of the range delegation on page 153 through 154. And then there's more language dealing with seven members on 155 and 156. On 157, there's language there dealing with some monies that were taken from what would have been an appropriation to the different mining companies for repairing plants, that if the money isn't used for the purpose it was used, it was intended to be used for, actually for a renewable energy project by Cleveland Cliffs, and if it doesn't happen, the money goes into the fund according to the where the mines were located. And members, I think there is one more. Oh, there's a wage subsidy program, and they're similar to MEAD of $1 million on page 159. And there's language on Mesaba Nugget payback. Both Mesaba Nugget paid back the deed money they owed to the 21st Century Fund and a deed, and they also paid back some money to the IRRB, and it just says that it goes into this account instead of the old 2002 fund, the Doug Johnson account. And the only other thing in here then would be the language on page, the rest of it is more seven members to approve dollars until I believe at the very end where there's a transfer from of money to a renewable energy project that I discussed with the commissioner for between Iron Ranch Resources and local units of government members, and that is the bill. And Mr. Chair and members, I'll stand for any questions from you, or, and then if not from the members, we'll let the audience testify on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions, members? Ms. Anderson?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rusavina, I have several questions, but I just want to start off with just the fact that I think I'll save my questions for tonight when I have a little bit more time to look over the bill. I'll just leave it at that for now.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing none, are there others that would like to come forward and speak to the bill?
Chair, do you?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, if there are members in the audience that want to comment on any specific parts of the bill right now, otherwise, Mr. Chair, we could, if there are no comments. I can't believe. But anyway, we'll come back, I believe, at 7.
Well, why don't we take care of a minute? And then we'll get to the announcement. Residents, welcome. Have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
Surely.
And I move we approve the minutes.
All right. All those in favor of approving the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Okay. So we will be in room 200 at 7 o'clock this evening, and we'll recess till then.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just so audience members know then, you know, it's my intention. I know Representative Carlson wants the bill by Thursday at the latest, so I talked to members of the minority. I met with them first and this morning, and I suggested that there would be amendments coming then this evening, and I hope also at that time then, Mr. Chair, to take to take comments from the audience if there are any comments after they look at the bill.
Okay. All right. We are then recessed.
Sit here if the committee doesn't mind. I'll take over to kind of smooth things along. But members, just a little schedule. So we're meeting tonight and tomorrow at 10:30 until 12:30 in room 5. And then if necessary, we'll take a lunch break, and then we'll be in the basement hearing room if we need to be from 1 to 2:30. And I want to start off by making a motion. I have to tell you, I screwed up and took a House File 860, which was a policy bill that came directly to my committee from the floor, and I can't re-refer it to the Finance Committee. So I want to move to strike House File 860 and then delete everything and replace it with House File 869, which is the Minnesota Higher Education Compact Bill, and I'm going to strike the language in there and delete everything after the enacting clause and insert it just like I did with House File 860. So my amendment is on the first page. I move to amend House File number 860. I want to delete 860 and insert House File 869, which is the MEHEC bill, which is in... has been sent from finance back to this committee. That will expedite the process of going back to finance instead of having to go to the floor for an extra day. And I screwed up by taking a policy bill instead of a finance bill. So it's a technical motion, and my mistake, and I apologize, Representative Murphy.
So, Mr. Chair, the Higher Ed Workforce Development Finance bill, the omnibus bill, will be what number?
It will be House File 869 instead of House File 860. They were both education bills, but one was a policy bill that isn't in the possession of the Finance Committee, and therein lies the problem. So everyone understands the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. And then I have... And so, just so you know, that the amendments are drafted to 860, but they will be exactly on the right lines because we just substituted 869 for 860. I have an amendment, 860 A3. The A3 will just go by the last letters, and the A3 amendment, it is the author's amendment on some technical changes, and the pages will pass out A3, and when the amendment is being passed out, there's nothing surprising in here. The first part of the language on lines 1.3 to 1.6 deal with the comment I made about wanting a little stronger language just to make sure that the programs we cut at the central office at Minsky, that the amount saved, like on the technology cuts and the awards of excellence, that that money flows to the campuses in the same allocation formula that's been in place for the last several years. And even though it's my fiscal analyst tells me I'm being redundant, I just want to be redundant.
Okay.
So that's what that does. The language on 1.8 to 1.11 and all the way down to 1.19 is putting this bill together and not being, and I stayed until Wednesday late, but this makes sure that the middle income scholarship at the university is not from the stimulus money, which it never was intended to be, but from general fund money.
so that the program can continue instead of being one time. And then the language on 120 to 125 puts that permanently in statute, because for those members who were on this committee 2 years ago, remember we had a middle income scholarship that was changed by the youth, so we're just putting this in statute. 126 was that reference I made that the on the alcohol being allowed to be served at Giant Bridge, which is technically owned by IRRRB, a state agency. The city of Bowabic annexed the town of White, and this just clarifies it's a technical change because it's no longer the town of White. And the rest of the language on page 2 was Mr. Coleman's language from the from his part of that change. He had talked to me about this, and I inadvertently forgot to put it in the bill where he can use the extra $45,000 from the cleanup contamination fund for administrative costs of the cost of administering that program. And finally, on the third page, on lines 3.5 to 3.6, Representative Sertich didn't want, even though it was for mercury abatement at the Hibbing public sewer facility, he just wanted public infrastructure projects. So that's what the amendment does. Are there any questions on the amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Public testimony. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify for or against or neutral or good or bad? And we have, it looks like, someone from the governor's office. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the case, please.
Mr. Chair, members, Jeremy Espenson, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I am here specifically in opposition to Section 20, well, on page 74, starting with lines 14, section 20, this section of the bill increases the surcharge for the Workforce Development Fund from a tenth of a percent to 0.12, and then has a 0.14 rate that is a surcharge that sunsets. We have some concerns about this because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, with no changes in law, because of the fact that unemployment numbers are going up so much and the experiential component of a person's calculation is going to go up so much, businesses are going to face about $200 million a year of increases for the next, through the projections in 2012. And we're concerned that even with this modest, about $20 million increase per year, that may just be too much. And while we understand what the chair is trying to get to here, providing more services for those folks who are unemployed, we're worried that any more burden on business may lead to further unemployment or reduced benefits to existing workers. Further, we're worried that this rate may not surcharge, and we worry about that simply because in 1990, when the dislocated worker program was created, it was scheduled to sunset, so that tenth of a percent was put into place in 1990. It was scheduled to sunset 1 year later. And the next year, the legislature came, removed the sunset provision, and that program continued to generate more money than was needed to accomplish the goals of the program for many years. And then in the late 90s, it turned into the Workforce Development Program. And you see it before you here with a number of expanded projects and things in the bill. So those are our major concerns, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Representative? Are there any questions, Mr. Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Essen, do you just want it to be left the way it is, or do you have a way that we could raise it a little bit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, our preference would be that it be left alone, that there be no further increase.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Essen, do you have any proof for us that it's going to be harmful?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, only to the extent that additional costs right now when businesses are really struggling would likely be harmful. I don't have any proof from a member company or anything like that.
such a little dick.
Well, Representative McFarland, you have an amendment, I believe, that deals with this, so why don't we take, thank you, Mr. Since there's no other questions, why don't we take up the A13 amendment then? Representative McFarland, it's being passed out. You just want to explain it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A13 amendment.
Okay. Go ahead.
I don't have it in front of me, but in essence, it does exactly what Mr. Esten has just presented with the Minnesota Chamber. I know my husband and I own a small business, and profit margins are so small right now. We'd rather keep our employees than to have to pay unemployment and all these. We currently have to pay these things anyway, but I think this is a real hardship on businesses. It may seem like a small amount, but you add this to every other increase that's out there that we have this year. It adds up.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland, could you, not right now, but at a later time, could you provide me with an idea of just in your business what it amounts to?
Sure. I could
appreciate that. Because I don't have a clue.
Well, members, you may recall, most of you on the committee, that we gave the commissioner the same language actually that Commissioner McElroy had, I believe, when he was the chair of this committee. And we said if times got tough, we gave him the right to raise the fee up to 0.12. He chose not to. I just think that we have to do something right now to help with retraining, which this money does. And Representative Farland, maybe we can talk a little bit about it, but at this time I prefer that members vote the amendment down. And
Mr. Chair?
Representative Farland.
I think when I saw the additional lines on 74.19 through 21, where it increases to 0.14% for the from 2009 to 2011, took me a little bit over the edge.
I know, but I did tell you that I was, you know, what I was going to do last week, Representative McFarland, and the total amount of money raised during the biennium, I believe, is $35 million, and then it goes back down to 0.12 in the next biennium, which would raise about $9 million, I believe, a year over, a little over $9 million over the base. And I just think, you know, hopefully that won't be that number back out in the next biennium. I'm hoping things get better, but I think right now we do need the money. There's been pressures. Representative Gunther knows that, where this fund has had to replace general fund money, and unfortunately Representative Gunther had the sad experience of chairing this committee during some tough times when he lost a lot of general fund money, and that workforce development fund fee replaced a lot of general funds. So with that, again, I hope the members voted down, and maybe we can work on a compromise as the bill moves along. Representative McFarland, Representative Welty, and then Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we have anybody from the audience that worked on this program or the funds that would be allocated, how they'd be spent, and if they could tell us what the current condition of the program is and how these additional funds would be used.
I don't even hear from the Workforce Development Council. I see it, Mr. Petro is here. I don't know. I think you're still on it. But Representative Gunther, did you want to respond directly to that?
Well, it's my understanding that the Dislocated Workers Program, one, returns about $45 million per year. It amounts to about $27 per employee per year that are full-time or make over X number of dollars, $30,000 a year. And with a .12, it would be $55 million or $10 million more, approximately. And then we get the stimulus money at $20 million, approximately. Then you look at all of the things that are getting money from there already before we do anything in this bill. And you have to admit that they are somewhat, if not completely, job-related. So we are spending the money at Dislocated Workers Program itself has got a track record that's the envy of the world, as far as I'm concerned. It takes someone laid off that the employer is paying $27 to $35 for the whole year, and it takes them and returns them to work within 12 weeks average at 80% of what they were paid before. Now, that's an average for you. That's pretty envious. So, dislocated workers program is one of them, Representative Murphy, that I wholeheartedly endorse. Whether we're going overboard taking things away from this program, I don't know, but never has been a time, in my opinion, that we've had more money to deal with than we are with the stimulus money right now. And like I said, the ME program is a program that we had before that I think was rather successful. That's taking $7.5 million out of this dislocated workers' money. And I can't knock that program. There are some that maybe I wouldn't like. I'm not from Minneapolis, so I don't like Minneapolis summer youth. Why are we paying for people to take care of the Minneapolis parks? They aren't doing that to Proctor or Fairmont. They are St. Paul, though. So you look at these things, somebody at one time or another decided these are important enough that we're going to take it out of the fund. So rightly or wrongly, this is the way it's been. And I remember a counting error in the Senate several years ago, like the chairman said when I was the chairman, they made a mistake in adding. The fiscal analyst did over there, and all of a sudden, all the money came out of here, but it was all returned right afterwards. And I noticed you have a two-year time period for the point 1.4. So when you look at it, I because the program works so well, I hope we'll have enough money with what's left, and I think we will, because we've never had this much money. We had $65 million once, never 85. So with the stimulus money, I think we're going to be fine. My hope, at least.
Ms. Elsie from Deep.
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bonnie Elsie, and I'm the director of the Workforce Development Division, which oversees the Dislocated Worker Program. And I am here to let you know that the kind of money that you are proposing to take out of the Dislocated Worker Program, including the increase in tax, we will be short, we estimate, by at least $12 million. The stimulus money has... Ann, do you want to come up here and join me? Ann, the stimulus money has almost all been obligated already. That's the kind of backlog that we have. We went into this fiscal year, we are going into the new fiscal year with no carry-in from the Dislocated Worker Fund. That has never happened before. We've always had about $18 million in carry-in. We do not have that. We're down to zero. We have given the locals to deliver services to dislocated workers through formula about $20 million this year. And with all the transfers that you are transferring out, regardless of the tax increase, you are transferring out an additional $14,320,000. I looked at what remained the same, what was new, and what reductions were in the dislocated from the Workforce Development Fund. A total transfer out of the fund is $15,540,000. You reduced it some programs by $1,220,000, but the net increase is $14,320,000. The dislocated worker program will run out of money if the layoffs continue. The other thing that I really want to emphasize is you're not going to have that money in fiscal year 2011 or 2010. It shows on your sheet that you're going to, if you put the tax in place on October 1st, the increase in tax on October 1st, the collections, the very first collections on that tax will occur in January, because that quarter ends December 30th. The employers have to pay that tax by the end of January. And what that increase will only be, the tax collections at the end of the year are only 10%. Typically, we get the money in 40% in the first quarter, which is at the end of April, 30% the end of July, 20% in October and 10% in January. So by the time the fiscal year ends, you'll have only collected 50% of that new money.
Well, as Elsie, I made the increase effective July 1 in the bill.
Okay, so if it was...
And
so
as Elsie, my fiscal analyst tells me that when all is said and done in the 10 and 11 fiscal year, that there is approximately close to $15 million of new money in the bill. And I didn't run the, the commissioner had the authority to raise the tax to 0.12, and I know there's no money left there. You had a meeting and you allocated it all out to the workforce centers, and I understand that at the beginning of this session. But in fact, you yourself tried to take the money to fund programs at the workforce, your state workforce centers, that the money had never been used for before.
That's serving dislocated workers, though. That was serving them in the workforce center.
Well,
that was not...
And we're going to be serving dislocated workers with the MEADS program and with the other programs that we funded the money with. So, members, Ms. Elsie, maybe you're not looking at this the same way I am, but I have to rely on my fiscal analyst, who tells me with the $35 million increase in the biennium, $35.35 million, that even with the new programs, including MEAD and other few programs, that were mostly all they did was replace the governor's cut. I don't think I have two or three programs where either that are new, Mr. Berg, do I? I have the Southeast Asian money and Representative Hayden still. And Representative Clarksville, and they're all, two of them are, or three of them are one time. In fact, the Asian one is one time, isn't it? So they're all one time programs. And they're very small amounts of money.
It still is an increase, though, of $14 million coming out of the fund.
Right, but you got $35 million coming into the fund.
But not all by the end of fiscal year 2010.
Yes, it is, because in the bill, I'm telling you to start collecting in July 1.
But that, it still won't, that will only be three quarters collected. Because
well,
the money, the first quarter, July 1 through the end of September, isn't collected till October. You're still going to lose a quarter. Because fiscal year, will end before the end of July. It ends in June, and in July you'll have 100% of that tax collected. But that's 3/4 of the year. That's not 100%.
Well, I don't think that we'll talk with you about your numbers. But I still, even using your scenario, there's still $10 million of brand new money. Not more money being spent, not less money, there's more money.
But the problem is we have no carry-in, so the money, the same amount of money for the dislocated workers is not going to be there.
I don't understand what you're saying. Mr. Berg, can you help me? Because I thought you and
because
I went over this. Mr. Berg, go ahead and
Mr. Chairman, no, I can't. The carry-forward isn't going to be there whether we raise the fee or not.
I understand that.
But so when we put new money in the bill that isn't spent elsewhere, it will be new money to the program.
Not to the dislocated worker program.
Yes, it will. That's the statutory purpose of any of the money that isn't spent otherwise in the bill.
But you're spending...
We raised $35 million, which will discount by one quarter, and we're spending less than 20 of it.
Okay, just a minute now. $35 million is 17... So you've got $17.5 million a year.
17.4 in 1 year, 17.9 in the next, yeah.
Okay.
What's
carry-in,
so far?
The carry-in in the dislocated worker fund has been about $18 million.
We didn't cause that problem, you did.
Oh, thank you.
So that can't be helped. That money's gone. I didn't do that.
I didn't say you did. I'm just saying the money won't be there for the dislocated workers. That's the point.
But it wouldn't be there if it doesn't have anything to do with this little increase.
or with what we're spending.
I'm not talking about the tax increase.
Well, then what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the amount of transfers out of the Workforce Development Fund.
Which are less than the transfers in.
That's what I'm talking about, because they're going for a number of different programs that weren't there before. They're new programs.
There's a few programs that are new, not many.
One big one
is the MEAD program.
The MEAD program.
Yes, which I said.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. So anyway, that's my point I was trying to make,
okay.
And I would also like to comment on some other parts of the bill.
Well, hold on just a second, though, because why don't we bring you back to do that, because we're on the amendment now dealing with this.
Okay.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to go back to the comments of the first testifier up here that brought the issue up. And it has to do with the compounding effect that businesses are going to feel in the next 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, because unemployment insurance rates are determined by your usage. And I don't know, maybe somebody from the department could tell us, what is the low rate and what is the high rate for unemployment insurance that employers might... I know, so... But could somebody tell us those numbers? What is the low percent if you have good experience, and the high percent if you have a lot of...
Mr. Nelson, do you want to come up from Deed? But I don't... Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, to your question, for a zero, what we call zero experience rated employer, in other words, they've had no history of layoffs, they will pay, it's fairly complicated, they will pay 0.4% on the first $26,000 of wages paid to each employee, plus a 14% surcharge of the taxes due. That's the minimum unemployment insurance tax. On top of that is any workforce development fees. For a maximum rate employer in 2010, it's 9.3% on the first $26,000 of wages, plus 14% of the total taxes due. The net, I suppose, maximum rate in Minnesota is essentially computed at about 10.3% of the first $26,000 of wages paid per worker. That's the range in Minnesota. Minnesota is the most experience-rated state in the nation. We charge those employers who have layoffs much more than other states do.
I guess that's my point, Mr. Chair, is that what we're experiencing now is unprecedented layoffs in the industry. All employers. Employers with good ratings are all of a sudden going to be looking at high experience ratings, and you can see the range of costs, that it goes from 0.4% up to 10%. So many employers are going to be climbing up that ladder of unemployment insurance costs very, very quickly because of the layoffs that they have. And then in addition to that, we're looking at this as an additional assessment under the unemployment insurance. And so I think that's really the issue. I'm going to get Representative Murphy's question. Is employers are hit hard in this arena when they start hiring employees back as their payroll grows again, because if they've laid people off, they obviously don't pay for their salaries. They're paying for the people that they have left. But as they hire people back, we're going to see some very significant increases in payroll costs, and at a time when employers really are having a very difficult time doing it. So I think it's a judgment call, but I think this is something that is really putting some unnecessary pressure on employers at a time when their best interest would be to give them as many tools as they can to get their employees back to work as fast as they can.
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, if I might clarify and put Representative Eastland's comments in perspective, employers are projected to pay unemployment insurance taxes in 2010 of just short of $1 billion in Minnesota. We're projecting that to increase by $200 million a year for the next 3 years after that through 2013. They will be paying $1.6 billion in 2013. Those are our projections. But while those significant tax increases will occur on Minnesota businesses already because of the experience rating, we do expect the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund to hit a deficit of $1.5 billion out there in 2011, even with those projected tax increases.
And you had expected that fund to be in trouble last year before even the this crisis, economic crisis, hit Mr. Nelson, if I recall correctly. But still, it has, you know, and Representative Easton, I understand the point you're trying to make, but it has really nothing to do with the workforce development fee to speak of. The whole UI experience rating, et cetera, other than the fact that it's, you can argue, another burden on business. Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ann Olson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. We represent the providers of the dislocated worker programs in the workforce centers. We're one of several partners that work out of the workforce centers across the state. I think one of the points that Ms. Elsie was trying to make is that we are very concerned about the amount of money that's available in the dislocated worker fund. We did an informal poll of our members. Obviously, everything is kind of a guessed estimate of the best that they can project given what's going on in the economy at this point. And they're projecting that even with the stimulus money, they would be between $12 to $20 million short to serve the number of people that they're currently serving. And that's given if things don't get worse than they are right now. We're seeing unprecedented numbers of people coming into the workforce centers asking for services through dislocated worker dollars that are provided there. So we do appreciate the fact that that the committee is looking for ways to put resources into those programs, and can assure you that if there are additional resources, even given what is being spent, it looks like there may be additional resources. If there are, they can definitely be used. We're trying very hard to serve all the people who are coming in, but any additional funding, again, even with the stimulus funds that we've received from the federal government, could certainly be put to good use for the people who are already waiting for services.
Okay. No further questions then? Representative Norris, excuse me.
Just a short comment. I guess the this increase would apply to all businesses, including retail, correct?
It's to all employers.
Yes.
It's a similar base as, I believe it's $28,000, sir, Mr. Sir.
And you don't need to go into any fine details. I just wanted to point that out. And retailers are also having a difficult time today, as well as manufacturers. And I just got word today that one of our businesses in my community is closing with about 12 jobs. And there's no other, there's no more payment going into the state because the business is gone, and there's, you know, there's loss all the way around. So anything we can do to lessen the impact on our business, I think, is positive in this particular environment.
Well, I'm hoping...
I'm supporting the amendment, basically, is what I'm saying.
Representative Nornis, and I'm hoping that 12 people that got laid off today will have the ability to go to their workforce center, which I think I gave some money even to the Perham one, which is not in, included in the workforce centers. And members, if you look in the bill on page 52, and there's actually some other places in there where I try to use all the workforce money, Wagner Pfizer, the American Recovery Act, to try to funnel as much money as I can to the workforce development centers, so, or workforce centers. So, Representative Gunter, and then we'll vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Elsie, why did you give all the money to the workforce centers? Why didn't you put some in reserve?
Ms. Elsie.
For major layoffs and stuff like that.
Because the need was there.
The need isn't in the large layoffs when the program is broke?
Well, yes, it is in the large layoffs, and it's in the small layoffs. And in the large layoffs, we are applying to the federal government for national emergency grants. We're hoping to get those from the federal government for the large layoff. But it doesn't matter if you come from a large layoff or a small layoff. Your need is the same. You're still unemployed.
Representative Gunter.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Elsie, we ignore one completely to pay the other one, it does make a difference. When somebody in a large layoff don't have a chance of getting any money from dislocated workers, and only the small layoffs can get us to the workforce centers, I think there is a difference there.
Ms.
Alfie. The layoffs can go to the Department of Labor. We go on their behalf and apply for National Aid Emergency Grants. The small layoffs cannot go to the federal government to ask for additional money.
Ms. Alfie, kind of to represent Gunther's point, but when that whole brouhaha broke out at the that Workforce Development Council meeting regarding the when you were trying to get money for the workforce centers, and then I think you were voted down. But at that time, did somebody tell me, and I can't remember if it was maybe Mr. Gersmeyer or somebody, that there was some money set aside for the larger layoffs that was, did that money get distributed? Wasn't there about $6.5 million?
Yeah, it's not there now, but there is still some money there.
For the larger layoffs.
For the large layoffs.
Okay. All those in favor of the 13th Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Amendment is not adopted. Representative Detmer offers the following amendment. Representative Detmer, you've got the athletic scholarship amendment. Do you want to take that first?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And that is the
A-10 amendment.
Go ahead. We'll be passing it out with the pages. If you want to explain it, Representative Detmer.
Yeah, there should be two pages. You should be getting the amendment and also a document from Menske.
Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, what the amendment does, it just states that if we're going to be using state funds, taxpayers' dollars for athletic scholarships, that it should go to a U.S. citizen. If you look at the sheet that you're going to be getting, it states how many dollars that Menske gets for athletic scholarships. They get $5.6 million. Of that amount, $500,000 is taxpayers' dollars. So what this amendment will do, it just states that if you're going to use taxpayers' dollars for scholarships, that it should go to a U.S. citizen. There's plenty of private money there in all the Menske system that can be used for any athlete that is recruited outside our country's boundaries. Right now in the Menske system, we have 65 athletes who are competing in the Menske system. And if you look at the sheet, the system total is 1,694 students who are competing in athletics in the Menske system. There's a total of $5,648,900 that are scholarship money. The average aid is $3,335. If you look over in terms of the athletic aid to U.S. citizens, there's 1,629 U.S. citizens. The total aid is $5,190. The average aid to those U.S. citizens is $3,186. If you look at the athletic aid to international or foreign national students, we have 65 students. The total aid is $458,000. The average aid is $7,059 for a foreign student. If you go down to the next category down there, the students receiving athletic-related financial aid by sport. Hockey, we have 40 out of the 65. All other sports, there's 25 for a total of 65. So I talked to the athletic director of St. Cloud State University. They received $1.3 million of athletic scholarships. 90,000 of that is state taxpayers' money. So I would probably, if I was a foreign student coming to the United States to compete, to get my education, body health care, everything else that goes along with my education there, I probably don't, it doesn't bother me which pocket that dollar comes out of, whether it's state funds or private funds. The majority of the money that is in our scholarship program are private funds. only 500,000 is state taxpayers' money that comes out of the that goes into scholarships. And I just want to support our athletes in the United States, support things that are made in America. You know that flags are to be made in America. Also,
he's 3 inches shorter than I am with that one.
Also, all clothing that is going to be sold in our bookstores and our colleges and universities will be made in America. I just feel that this $500,000 that is taxpayers' money should be provided for athletic scholarships and education for U.S. citizens. The rest of the money, almost $5 million, is private money, can be used any way the colleges see fit.
Okay.
Thank you.
President Detmer, well, nothing made me more proud. By the way, if I could get 94 or 5% or 6 or 7% of all the goods at Minsky sold that made in the USA as compared to not, I'd be happy. But nothing made me more proud the last couple weeks than to see your alma mater in the final Frozen Four, a little town of Bemidji, Minnesota, with a 5,000 student population, beating the likes of Vermont and Cornell and who else and whomever.
Notre Dame.
And, you know, I just can't believe that went over your head, Representative.
No. I know alumnus of Bemidji State.
And I think they had a few Canadians on that team.
I'm sure they did.
And
I think, Mr. Chairman, I don't think those Canadians care whether they get private money or state money. There's much more private money out there for scholarships than state money.
But I think your school at Bemidji probably has a lot of it in state money. And, you know, even if you look at your own numbers, Representative Detmer, they're just so minuscule, the amount of students, 65 out of 1,694. It just, I can understand, you know, it's kind of a made in America thing, so I do understand where you're
from. I know you do.
Yes,
I know you do.
But I think it just, the numbers speak for themselves as far as not really being a problem. And just the goodwill that Bemidji got out of what they were just, out of that Frozen Four, I think will bring back to the state of Minnesota much more than the cost of those few Canadian hockey players. So,
but Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
This amendment will not prevent Bemidji or Duluth or St. Cloud or Mankato from recruiting athletes outside the U.S. boundaries.
I know, but I think those smaller schools that would hurt Representative Detmer, because I think a lot of their money is this state aid they have to get versus the private money that a University of Minnesota or a bigger school may get, where they can provide scholarships that weren't state funded.
But this, Mr. Chairman, this bill does not affect the University of Minnesota, and I would think that the rest of Minnesota colleges are the same as St. Cloud, basically, and St. Cloud gets $1.3 million of scholarship, and the majority of that is private money. Only $90,000 is state taxpayer money.
Representative Detmer, the bill does also affect the University of Minnesota on line 1.6, but be that as it may, you've drafted it to both the university and the Minsky system. Representative Brenner.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if someone from the University of Minnesota or Minsky would like to comment on the amendment.
Is there anyone here from either Minsky or the university that would like to comment on the Detmer amendment?
It's not.
Oh, there is. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Marty McDonough from the University of Minnesota. When we had this initial discussion with Representative Detmer, we consulted with our athletics department, and at the university we do not use any state money for athletic scholarships.
At any of the coordinate campuses?
That's my understanding.
So even though it's drafted Representative Detmer, then I apologize, it won't affect them. I thought that it might affect UMD or Crookston or whatever.
I don't believe so.
Canadians coming over the border over there in Crookston. But anyway, Okay, any further questions? If not, all those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? No. No. Motion does not prevail. Amendment does not pass. Next amendment, Representative Detmer, do you have another one on the Hugo Storm? Yes. Representative Detmer?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
The
A26
amendment. Representative Detmer, dealing members with the Hugo tornado.
Mr. Chairman, I think back in March, everybody in the committee should have got this letter from Hugo. Everybody remember they got the letter from Hugo? And you saw the video. And the city of Hugo was asking for $448 million for the $438,000 for the tornado relief fund. And as we see in the bill that is, as it is brought forward to today, there was a lot of $250,000. So, again, if you look at the devastation that occurred by the city of Hugo, we really need to be taking a look and see where we can find some more money within this bill. So I'm looking at page 44, line 9, that we would add $7,000 for the first year just from the general fund of the tornado relief for the city of Hugo. I think this is one of the main purposes of what we do here is to provide emergency aid to cities, whether it's floods or devastation like a tornado is, or an ice storm, whatever the case may be, is that these are the types of things we need to do as a legislature to provide funds for these towns. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to have a roll call.
Okay. Representative Detmer, I tried to help you as much as I could, and you know that the commissioner and McElroy had said that he would try to find you money, and instead I found you some money, so I tried to do as best as I could for you, and I understand. Members, you can do what you want. I don't think you need a roll call. I'll support the amendments. I know there's $70,000 on the bottom line, and we'll probably have to find a little more money because I know there's another couple of programs that might cost a little more, but I'll do what I can.
Mr. Chair, I'll withdraw the roll call.
So, you know, I can't. I mean, we'll have to find some more money. So I know you'll help me find it somewhere. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, is our bill predicated on the $1.5 billion in new revenue coming into the to the tax increase we're going to have to buy or pass, or are we, if we don't pass that, does our bill, do we have to come back and redo your bill?
I think our bill is predicated on us passing the $1.5 million in new revenue and us making a few billion dollars in cuts.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, are you going to vote for the tax increase?
Representative Detmer.
Is that something that he should be asking me,
no.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
I tried that on the floor once.
I'll withdraw the question.
You're not in courtroom.
I was reprimanded when I asked that on the floor. I mean, I was a freshman. I'm not a, you know.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Mahoney, you're not a freshman. No.
Representative Detmer, I don't understand your amendment. Are you asking for $250,000 for the city of Hugo and $70,000?
Representative Detmer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative. Yes.
Thank you.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Nope.
Motion prevails. I'm a soft touch, Representative Detmer. I know you'll vote for the tax bill.
Yeah.
Representative Stolberg, Representative Mahoney, are all offer the following amendment. It's the A6 amendment. Representative Stolberg had asked this. He got the bill in a little late, and we didn't have a hearing on it. It deals with the, if you want to pass it out, it deals with an issue for Minnesota Diversified Industries, and I'll have Representative Solberg describe the bill. Or the amendment, A6 amendment.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This particular amendment would allow the Department of Employment and Economic Development to give a grant to, in effect, the Minnesota Diversified Industries, which employs people with disabilities. And they have been, in the past, been part of the base of a grant. They have plants in Grand Rapids, giving in St. Paul, and they had some trouble with their administration. If you recall, the fact is about 3 years ago, they hired a new CEO, and the CEO took some of the employees on a bus trip, remember, to, as an entertainment, and ended up not being around very long. Consequently, they did not get in the paperwork that they wanted to get in at the time, and so they lost their base grant, and this just says, this gives them a grant back to what they had before from the recovery fund. So it's one-time grant at the present time.
And are there any questions on the amendment? Any comments from Deed? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sure Representative Solberg knows this, where the money's coming from, but I just have to ask, where is the money coming from?
American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
But isn't that already all expensed?
Well, Mr. Chair, my understanding is there's two different things. There's, it's not the stabilization fund. It's funds that go directly into Deed. My understanding, and we have the option of appropriating it if we wish.
Right. So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Anderson.
So, this is a kind of a carve-out, then?
It's a carve-out, that's correct. Yeah. Okay. Any questions? And, ma'am, Mr. Chair, members, it is restoring what they've had in the past.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, and I missed the amount here. I've got a blank here. How much did you say?
$500,000.
On line 1.9, that's been ended. Any further questions or comments? Go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is John Sherman. I'm with the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Unit at Department of Employment and Economic Development. There are a couple of issues with this that probably the committee may wish to hear about. First of all, it's not clear which set of dollars the bill would come from. I'm assuming that these dollars would be taken from those funds that came through ERA for the Rehabilitation Services 110 program, which is different than the Department of Labor funds that have come through its Department of Education funds. Those funds have a set of restrictions that we've finally begun to get word from the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. on what we can use the dollars for and what we cannot. And what basically we have found is we can use them for the existing purposes. Much of the original request for Minnesota Diversified Industry does not match those funds. They were replacing extended employment dollars, which are state funds and which are not eligible for essentially federal funding. And so part of the issue with this language is that it is not clear in terms of how we would use them. And we have been advised, and in fact it came into the office after I left this afternoon, we've been advised that there are issues enough that if we had a federal look-back audit, we may very well be required to repay those dollars. We'd be willing to work with the committee and with Representative Solberg to see if we can get better language. I know that at least the bill was to be heard in the Senate tomorrow, and I'm not sure now at this point. I believe it has been pulled back there.
Okay, Mr. Sherman, you know, there were several appropriations under the stimulus package in different categories. There was the WIA money for the different accounts, and there was a specific appropriation, I believe, for vocational rehabilitation. And other, could that money come out of there?
The assumption is, and because it's generically the ARRA, it could come out of any, I suppose, appropriated.
Would there be money then available under that appropriation you got under vocational rehabilitation? I think it was in the couple $1 million range of, in the stimulus package, wasn't it?
I'm not as, my expertise is not on what's outside that, Representative Rifkin. I apologize. I'm not, I can't answer that question. We could get back to you.
But, Mr. Chairman, doesn't the language as Representative Solberg had it drafted give a lot of leeway to the department?
It would give a lot of leeway to the department.
Can you work with Representative Solberg then if we put it in, if you're not comfortable with the way it's written? But I think several of those different stimulus package dollars, whether it was vocational rehab or there was some extended unemployment or whatever, would probably be used for the purpose of the Minnesota Diversity Right Industry. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's drafted with as much flexibility as possible because at the time of the drafting, you know, there's rules coming down. It's over the. I want to give the department as much flexibility as well with that. And if there's other language that they need to have to clarify that, we're willing to work. But I think it's drafted with lots of flexibility.
Representative Downey and then Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess this is maybe for Representative Solberg or from the testifier from Deed. Can you describe this program a little bit more and the circumstances that led to their not being able to come forward? We saw a number of pretty complete presentations from the other line items in the workforce development grants, and now here's one $500,000 where we haven't really seen anything. We saw good data on the people served and the jobs created and those kinds of things. Can somebody give us more information so we might get comfortable with this program?
Representative Solberg, probably for you and not Mr. Sherman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downing, the MDI program is a program that employs people that have difficulty with disabilities, for lack of a better word. They have both mental disabilities and physical disabilities. They have had contracts with the U.S. Department of Post Office for some of their work. They've had one of those contracts was pulled back a little bit because the post office did not need as many of the trays as what they were making. My understanding also is they've had some difficulty with administration. They have a new administrator that is dealing with it. And my understanding is that they had an ongoing grant of $500,000 from the state. And because of lack of paperwork, that was not put in a timely fashion. And so they lost their base support for that. This is a program that is extremely important for people that would normally be not working. Would be welfare recipients, for lack of a better word. It gives them dignity. They get to up and go to work in the morning. And this is a way to be able to make sure that program keeps going. And I know it's one-time money, but then they have to work for the rest of it for an ongoing basis as well.
Okay. Heard the comments then. Mr. Sherman, anything else to ask? I expect Representative Solberg will work with you tonight, not for my own.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Solberg, Representative Downey asked one of the questions that I had, but I'm just curious, aren't we kind of duplicating some services here? I'm just looking at lines 46.12 of the bill and 46.28, and there we're providing services to individuals that have disabilities and suffer from mental illness disabilities as well. And one is for $150,000, another one's for $1.6 million. Is it something, and in particular, couldn't the same group work with, I think, the line 46.28, couldn't they secure those or try to secure those funds through that chief instead, and maybe that buys them some more time to kind of get their house in order.
If I could, Representative Anderson, and I think that was a item that was has been in previous bills, and there's no change to that, and that was for a program, you're right, for maybe the same constituency, but for a different company. I think that's a non-profit group, if I'm not mistaken. Mr. Burke, do you want to explain it? See, the Minnesota Diversified Industries actually has these people working. Representative Solberg said, I know they made those cartons for storing plastic cartons that the United States Postal Service uses. They had some other contracts, and then there was trouble, and so the company got in trouble. And these are both physically and mentally handicapped folks, along with, I think, some hard-to-employmental illness problems, too.
And Mr.
I think they're different constituents.
I think it's a little bit different constituents in that they probably don't have a mental illness or are not under court order.
But I think it actually was a job. These were for, they actually work at a job, and the other one is for training and technical assistance for them to get training. Maybe, Mr. Sherman, you can help us out on the difference between diversified industries and advocating change together.
I would be glad to, Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg and Representative Anderson. Advocating Change Together is an organization that operates a statewide self-advocacy program for individuals with developmental disabilities. And basically what they do is they work in local communities and work with some of the folks who are in our program on their on the individual self-advocacy skills. And it's a very small program, but it's not a direct employment program.
With
and
Minnesota Diversified
Industry. Minnesota Diversified Industry was a community rehabilitation program that, slightly about 3 years ago had very bad management.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has a set of issues in that the funding, most of its employment, which was very good employment, was based on what is called a federal niche contract that the Postal Service contracts, both in making the totes and in making stamps. Those contracts have disappeared largely. They're maybe 20 or 25% of what they were 2 years ago. And so there's been definite fiscal issues attached to the organization. And they failed essentially for 2 years to provide any fiscal reports to us, to the organization, to deed on what they were doing. This is all the prior management. And frankly, they let time run out on the process. And the requirements of that we ask of them are the same requirements we would ask of any other community rehabilitation program under the extended employment funding rule.
And now they do have new management as Representative Solberg explained earlier.
Mr. Chair, they have a very good, competent management. It was in place since, I think, January of this year or November of this last year.
So we've heard the amendments. And any further questions then? Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, hopefully Representative Solberg would be amenable to this. I think at the very least we should ask this organization to meet the standards set forth by DEED so that we know that we're putting our money towards something that is solid and that we aren't.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am confident that the new management will operate as they are supposed to operate. Minnesota Diversified Industries has been around for quite a few years, had good management, had very good success on it, and then had bad management, I guess, for lack of a better word, and just was incompetent. They have made the changes that are necessary, have put stringent management practices in place, with a very confident person. So I would agree wholeheartedly with you, Representative Anderson, and I will make sure that, that the message goes back to them that they have to follow.
Go
ahead.
Representative Solberg, so then are you going to be adding language then at some point that just says upon them providing the support?
Mr. Chairman, I will work with DEED to make sure that they have language that they're comfortable with, too.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Nordis, the A-17 amendment. And I think it's been passed out, Representative Nordis.
I believe so. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A-17 amendment does a couple of things. The bill that we're looking at tonight extends to a fifth year eligibility for state grants as far as students are concerned. That fifth year was eliminated some years ago, partly for financial reasons and partly because we felt students needed to be nudged a little bit to get hopefully through in 4 years instead of five. The bill goes back to that fifth year again, and so my amendment is eliminating the fifth year. And in doing so, we can do a couple of positive things for students. One would be to lower even further the student share by an extra 1%. That dramatically lowers the cost of the college education for the students. And it also then will free up some additional funding. Oh, by the way, I should ask if you can, would you accept an oral amendment?
You bet.
Sure. On line 1.6, where you've got 100,000.
You want 200 there or what?
No, I'm going to leave a little change. 170. 170,000.
All right.
All right.
Well, you already got a 70, so... You just go to 30 then, Representative.
We're trying to help Hugo and students tonight.
And you're taking that from the general fund.
That's the savings of not doing the fifth year. That's how we're...
So you're taking money from the student grant program and giving it
for that fifth
to
year.
A tornado program.
Well, a little bit of it. Most of it's going to reduce student share by
1%. Okay.
And I'd like a roll call, please. And questions, too, if you have any.
Okay. Members, now, with the oral amendment, you are getting more money than Representative Detmer originally asked for. So, Representative Detmer, do you want all that money? Maybe we should up it to $1 million or something. I don't know what's going on over there, but I think 70... Mm-hmm. Thousand plus 170,000 is 240 plus 250 is 490.
So how much?
Well, okay, we have the amendments in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Oh, it's a roll call. Well, members,
did we act on the amendment?
We'll the just amendment incorporate it as a friendly amendment to you.
Amended.
Okay.
Members, I would hope that we vote against the amendment. We're taking money now from student grants program. I think if you look at what was done in the bill, with the Pell money, with the Achieve money, with the reducing the two-year cap, we picked up $95.5 million. We went with a $16 million expense for Representative Atkins' bill. We increased the living and miscellaneous expense by $700 for every person eligible, which cost us $45.5 million. We increased the four-year maximum, which cost us $2.2. We did the fifth-year eligibility, which I will argue with you, Representative Nornes. In today's climate where you have a lot of people, non-traditional students going back, it's taking a longer time. So members, I think, and I think people walked out of here this afternoon from all the different colleges, from all the different privates and publics, and the students themselves who are still sitting over here, I see that everybody was very happy with what we did in the state grant program. Everybody. So members, I hope you would have voted against the amendment, and the clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair, before you take...
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that Representative Nornes wanted to make a change to his amendment. I'd like to defer to him.
Oh, Representative Nornes,
Mr. Chair, we've kind of straightened out the problem with the 100,000 and 170,000.
You want to just delete that?
I want to go back to 100,000. No, we'll go to 100,000.
Okay.
And now you can vote.
All right. We'll leave the original language as it is in the amendment then. Rukavina votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Captain.
No.
Why?
No.
Reiner.
No.
Gutman?
Yes.
Jones?
No.
Meacham?
Yes.
Spencer?
Yes.
Pond?
No.
Mahoney?
No.
McFarland? yes. Murphy?
Yes.
Yes. No!
I go for two out of three.
Maybe.
Murphy goes, no. Norton?
Yes.
Norton?
No.
Obermuller?
No.
Pop? No.
Reinert? Wilson? Welty?
No.
There being 12, I believe. 12 no's and 6 yeas, the motion does not prevail. Representative Anderson, you have 2.
I think this left, Mr. Chair. You can get a vote up in another
case. Okay, Representative Gunther, would you like to do the left? There he is leaving.
They told me to handle it for him.
Are there any? I withdraw all my amendments and I'd like to vote on the bill.
Okay. Representative Mahoney, would you like to do one of your several amendments?
I sure can. Which one would you like to do? Would you like to do the 8-4, the Pine Island, or would you like to do the study group?
We will do the Pine Island amendment, the 8-4 amendment. Representative Mahoney, do you want to start discussing it as we pass it out?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The A4 amendment directs deed to use out of the redevelopment fund, the bioscience grant, to make a grant for infrastructure to Pine Island and the Elk Run Biopark of up to $2 million to be used for the design and construction of the publicly owned water and sewer infrastructure at Elk Run Bioscience Park. Members, I am not saying that it has to be $2 million, but I'm trying to send the message to DEED that they need to get this out to this park so they can finish this up and get these this bioscience park going. We have a venture capital fund that is on the verge of raising $1 billion to purchase East and West Coast companies and bring them to the Twin Cities to this particular facility, which is about 15 miles north of Mayo. It is a real plum for our state and for our science-based economic development. With that, I'll stand for questions.
Are there any questions from the members? Can anybody from DEED come up forward on this and comment on it? Mr. Coleman, is this one of your programs that... it is, isn't it? Mr. Coleman.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Terry Coleman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority, but I'm also under contract with DEED to manage several programs, including the Bioscience Infrastructure Grant Program. And we're not opposed to this at all. I mean, they have an app in for a little less money, about $1.5 million. I guess they want to do a few more things in their industrial park. So,
this is the gentleman from California that I have seen.
Well, the city wants to put in water, sewer, and streets.
But it's for that project.
For that park. And, yeah, the $1 billion talking about is kind of tied to that industrial park with partnership with Mayo and a few other entities.
And does this? What does this do to the fund itself as far as other obligations?
It expands the cap, I think, up to $2 million is what it does. But I think right now we have a policy of $1 million, and if an exceptional project we go up to $1.25 million. This brings it up a little higher. But there is money in the program. We don't have a huge demand for the bioscience infrastructure like we do the Greater Minnesota Business Infrastructure, so we do have the funds for it.
Okay. there's no opposition from B, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Mahoney, do we have another one for the pages that passed out? Representative Mahoney, which one would you like to take up next? You've got the study. You want to take up, Representative Beard had that study language. And I never really, he kind of wanted a hearing and then he didn't want a hearing, so you've got something to address that, right?
Mr. Chair, I do.
And that would be
The A11 amendment.
A11 amendment pages. If you would, go ahead and try and explain that while it's being
passed. Mr. Chair, this is truly a bipartisan amendment. Not only am I signed on to it, but Representative Gottwall, Beard, Poppy, and Overmiller. And if I could have gotten to the rest of my committee, I think everyone would have signed on to it. Calls for $70,000 to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for an Economic Development Strategy Working Group we are asking the Humphrey Institute to lead this working group that calls for 18 members, six senators, six House members, and six from the private sector. And my hope is that they are economic development professionals, and they are to provide some guidance, I'll put it that way, or the ability to bring forth legislation next year, and they will conduct an academic effort to perform the best practice research in economic development going on, the principles that apply to Minnesota, access Minnesota's current economic strategies, including tax incentives and appropriated funded programs, develop a comprehensive strategy to move Minnesota's economy forward, develop a set of benchmarks to measure Minnesota's investment in economic development strategies, and recommend the best structure to govern and lead Minnesota's economic development. And they're to come back with a report by February 15, 2010. This hopefully will be led by one of the professors over at the Humphrey Institute. Pays for her salary, their salary, and a couple of research assistants. And they will do the research and kind of in a nonpartisan way tell us what is best for the state of Minnesota rather than view it through a political lens. Economic development is too important to the state and to our future to play politics with it.
Questions on the amendment? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, I'm just wondering on the looking at lines 1.15, if you'd be willing to make it so that it's an even distribution. You say you have the working groups consist of six members of the House of Representatives and three members of the public appointed by the Speaker of the House. Are we going to have equal representation as far as membership goes? Three members from the majority and three members from the minority.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I would prefer not to. I have been working very hard to keep this very nonpartisan and not put labels of people onto it. And I have had conversations with the Speaker and made my comments to her, and I don't think it's necessary.
Well,
Representative Anderson.
Representative Mahoney, I can appreciate what you're trying to do, but from my perspective, considering that the Speaker of the House is from the majority party, it is partisan already. And I'm just wondering if we can take out that partisanship by making it so that it is equal representation and fair to everybody involved. I understand what your intent is. I would hope that that's the intent of the Speaker, but just to give me a little more comfort, that's what I'm looking for. I think this is a good deal. I'm looking for some comfort.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Again, I'm sorry if you're uncomfortable with that particular language. I am not trying to short your party, but I don't think it's necessary, and I would ask that we not put that in. I have worked too hard to try and keep this, keep as much politics as possible out of this, and I've had a good number of conversations with leadership, and they've assured me that they will. I have already named a couple of people from your side of the aisle that I thought would be very, very good, and there was some receptiveness to those particular names.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mahoney. I'm questioning kind of the scope and the focus of this. We talk about, and actually I'm actually pretty supportive. I think that's one of the things we've lacked in Minnesota for a long time is a more kind of overall coordinated effort from kind of R&D at the seminal research stage at the universities all the way to business incubation. So if we're getting at that, I'd be actually very supportive of this. So we talk about reviewing and analyzing Minnesota's current economic development strategy. Are we talking about the state government's economic development strategy or all of Minnesota? I'm just curious about what the scope of Minnesota's strategy is.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, the intent is the state of Minnesota's economic development policy, not whether business XYZ has this particular plan or not. It's focused more on how we develop
and other
how we develop policy to help businesses grow in the state of Minnesota.
And then, if I could, Mr. Chairman, second question, Representative Mahoney, the non-legislative members. Is there any, preconceived notion of who those would be? Are we going to have statewide business leaders? Will it be some business partnership or chamber members? Or what's the vision for the makeup of this group?
Mr. Chair, the non-public members, or the public members, are focused on economic development professionals, whether they are from Halleck or Winona or Worthington or Grand Rapids or Grand Marais or anywhere in between. We just look for the best and brightest of that particular group that would like to sit on this particular committee.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Norton.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask the author a question, but I couldn't interrupt him while he was asking, so I'm just going to ask this publicly, and it relates to Representative Anderson's comments earlier, and because I do not believe this is meant to be partisan in any way, and yet I don't necessarily agree with her solution, I wondered if the author would be interested in on line 1.15 saying that it was a bipartisan working group. That way it would assure some representation without being so specific and as having to delve into how many and all that. So that was just a suggestion.
I certainly can incorporate that, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Norton, are you asking us to read the bipartisan working group consists of six members? Okay. Or on line 1.13, an 18-member bipartisan working group?
That would be probably more helpful.
Okay. Members understand that? You just want to incorporate that as a friendly amendment?
Incorporate that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And then we have the full amendment in front of us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Anderson, you had left earlier. I wanted to do, you have a couple of bills on the higher ed course, and do you want to do the tuition one first?
The A25?
Yes.
Sure.
Do the members of the committee have the A25 amendment? The members of the audience. Okay. Representative Anderson, where's mine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members,
could the chair have a copy of the amendment? Thank you. Go ahead.
Members, we heard in committee earlier this year about students that are experiencing significantly high student service fees. I saw one fee statement from UMD, my alma mater, fee statement where they were paying $2,000 just in their fees and their tuition was $4,000. I think that's ridiculous that your student service fees are half the cost of your tuition, and I'd like to try and get a handle on that. So on the bill here, we talk about holding the line on tuition increases. I'd like to include in that fee increases as well, and this is what this amendment does.
Okay, Representative Obermuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Do you know, and it's just because I haven't been around here enough maybe to know this, but I thought we had testimony that a lot of the fee increases, the fees that were in the students' bills were actually ones they had voted themselves benefit to, you know, the fee themselves, essentially. Do you know what percentage of that is, and will this affect those fees that they've voted in?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Obermiller, I think what you'll find, is, and that's been my experience, I actually served on my student service fee when I was in college, and the fees are not voted on by the body, the entire body of the student population. They're voted on by a small group of some students and then also administrative staff for whatever college that you serve on. At least that's how it was at my college. So no, you're not getting a complete buy-in from the entire student population, and that's one of the reasons why I introduced a bill this year that gets at that issue. So there you have it.
Representative Anderson, to that point, did you ask for a hearing on that bill? Because I don't remember seeing one.
Mr. Chair, from the feedback that I got from some of your fellow members, I decided to hold off. I'm going to be asking for a hearing next year. But since I know that it's not a criteria in this committee to have new initiatives come before the committee without having had a hearing in the committee, I assume that you would be acceptable for this.
Did I indicate that I wouldn't support your idea? No, I don't think I did. Mr. Fitzenritter and maybe someone, Ms. Borgen, do you want to come down or somebody else from MinSU and talk to the amendment? Mr. Fitzenritter, yeah. You want to go first then?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Fitzenritter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. If I understand the author's amendment, what I believe the amendment is doing is shoehorning into that $300 limit on tuition that's in the bill now any additional increases from any fees that the university may do have to also fit within that $300, which in effect, because it's under the stabilization money, we would be using stabilization funds to temporarily buy any fee increase down as well that was planned. I think that's what the amendment is doing. I will say that some of those fee increases, and to my recollection right now, we don't have a lot of those planned increases in the next 2 years, but a couple of those aren't under our control. Because the language is so broad, I presume it would include, for example, any increase that the Met Council puts on the university for the MetroPass program, which is a fee that students pay. There's also health insurance fees that we don't necessarily control those going up because health insurance costs go up. It would also get a little messy because the intent of the original language is for Minnesota resident undergraduates, yet we'd have fee increases hitting non-residents. I guess that's okay. I think if the committee needs to do this, it would be better to limit it to required fees if you were going to do it, as opposed to just any fee. That would help some to narrow it. But I think our position is the $300 was a carefully crafted number that would result in tuition increases for a Minnesota resident not going up more than 3% in any of the 2 years. And to add additional burden into that, I guess we'd like to revisit the $300.
Okay, Ms. Borgen, do you want to give them MinSU?
Yeah. Judy Borgen, Associate Vice Chancellor for Budget at MinSU. First, our fees our board sets maximum fees, and an institution within our system can decide when to increase those fees. Some of them may not have increased them to a maximum, others have. It would be complicated for us because each one of our institutions is at a different place in terms of their fees. Again, I think, like Mr. Fitzenritter says, if it is broadly applied, we certainly have fees that in our revenue fund and with our, I don't know if it applies to our room and board rates and things like that, but it certainly would complicate things in terms of those increases.
There are students, certainly I think it was brought up that students do in some ways approve some of the fees, like student activity fees. At least they recommend an increase in those fees to the president at their institution, and as long as it is under the maximum for that institution, the president is often, approves those kind of fees. So I think, again, like Mr. Fitzenreiter says, we were looking at planning on revenues at 5% with a buy-down for our students, and that was the tuition to be able to support the general operations. And again, we would want to revisit those percentages, I think, if we were looking at putting fees into that.
Members, maybe, and for the audience too, maybe this is a good time for me to talk about the whole use of the stimulus money to buy down using stimulus money to buy down those increases to 300 the first year, and then another 300 on top of that the second year, and that means to do the 5% and the 5% and buying it down to 2. Both systems, first of all, let me start by saying that I privately met with Governor Pawlenty about a different issue at all, not relating to the whole higher ed workforce development bill. And while I was in there, Governor Pawlenty asked me if that he wanted to be blamed and that he wanted caps put on at both the university and the Minsky system. So I went back to both systems and talked to the, Mr. Fitzenreiter, President Krunick. I talked to Ms. King and a few others at the MSU system. And, these numbers might have to be a little bit in flux as this bill goes through, but I do want to publicly say this. This is one-time money. We're trying to use the stimulus money to buy down, but we are warning the students, and I want everybody to know this, and we are warning, I think, the people of this state that, come 2000, the next biennium, there are going to be some big increases. They aren't. Public universities and community college systems and the University of Minnesota, or there are going to be some huge cuts, or there are going to be a combination of both, unless this economy turns around. And I think, it was what the governor requested of me, and both systems came through with these different proposals, and this is the way we came through with it. But, I just as soon leave things as they are in the bill because they were worked out with the systems. But I do want to just publicly state for the record that what we have in the bill is an increase coming in tuitions of 5% in Minsky and another 5% on top of that, and at the university, what the Board of Regents is going to vote, which could be coming up in 2012 and 13 biennium, we could see 10% or more, bang, right away when the cliff is hit. And at the university, I'm probably talking better than 1,000, 1,200, whatever, in tuition. So, everybody got to know that. And the alternative is massive layoffs, massive cutting programs, or hopefully an economy that brings more money into the system and that we can give a bigger appropriations to both of our higher ed systems. So, with that said, Representative Anderson, a final, and Downey, and then Representative Downey, why don't you go first and let your comrade over there wrap it up then on the amendment. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the hard work you've put in the kind of the rock and the hard place here between. But I really want to challenge our higher education institutions and maybe especially the University of Minnesota. I've been picking through some of this data over a 25-year history here. And, tuition has gone up 587% in the last 25 years. Consumer Price Index has gone up 115%. Our funding, our general fund appropriation to the University of Minnesota has gone up 173%, well above CPI, and yet we're not keeping pace. And I remember back to a late night session where I asked a question, I think it was with Mr. Fitzenreiter,
the pie chart of the allocation of administrative versus student expenses at the University of Minnesota, whether that had changed over the last 25 years, and his answer was that it had not. And I really think there's another solution here. It isn't just that we got to find a way to raise revenue or add tuition. I really want to challenge the University of Minnesota. We got a new set of Board of Regents. Every single one of them sat in my office and committed to me that they would apply business practices and reforms and find ways to cut costs and get more efficient. I really think there's a component here for the University of Minnesota to step up and participate in this, and for us not to simply accept that another 25 years of 587% tuition increases should just get a free pass. I would encourage us over the next 2 years. We got a two-year free pass. The stimulus money gives the University of Minnesota 2 full years to try and restructure some of their costs and figure out how to do business better. And I would like to challenge them to do that and participate in this as well, and not simply put it on us and our economy to somehow compensate and cover for that. Thank you.
Representative Dolly, I don't disagree that there could probably and there should be some real tough looks at things, but let's not forget that, you know, what happened in 2003 to both systems, I believe a 300 and some million dollar cut to the both systems, and then let's not forget what happened after that too, and there were double digit increases many years in a row. There's still students sitting out there in the audience from both the 2 and 4 year systems at MINSU that went through that. One of them is one of my students who from Mesabi, I think, who actually might have voted for me once or so. Anyway, even with those tuition increases. So, you know, we're trying not to have that happen again, Representative Dolan, but I just wanted to be perfectly honest with what could happen, you know, because we're using that stimulus money to try to serve the students as best we can, but it can't, it's not sustainable, so. Representative Anderson, then, to Ender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask for a roll call. And then also, Mr. Chair, members, this fee increases, fees in general have become the hidden cost for parents and students going to college. And it's a real eye-opener to them when they first get that first fee statement. And if they weren't aware of it when they were first registering for classes, boy, it kicks you in the teeth when you see that kind of money that is being doled out. And this is just an attempt to get at that issue. I think, Representative Rukavina, your comments of, you know, if things don't get better, you know, we're really in the soup, is all the more reason of why we need to put this language in place and protect the students and the families that support them in their college career. So I ask for your support.
Members, I hope you don't approve this because it could lead to some serious repercussions as far as the programs offered, cuts to personnel, etc. And I think we're trying to ease them into that, Representative Anderson, in the bill with some language that tries to prepare us with both proposals from the University of MINSU as to how they're going to approach the 12-13 budget. So I hope that we can just leave the bill as it is. The clerk will take the roll. Of the Unable Snow.
Anderson. Aye.
Atkins. No.
Bly.
No.
Reiner. No. Clark. Detmer.
Yes.
Downey.
Yes.
Eastman.
Aye.
Gunther.
Aye.
Parr.
No.
Mahoney.
No.
McFarland.
Aye.
Murphy.
No.
Norris. Norton.
No.
Obermuller.
No.
Poppy.
No.
Reiner. Slocum. Welty.
Yes.
Motion does not prevail on 10-7 votes. Representative Anderson offers the A-16 amendment. Representative Anderson, it's the language dealing with the presentation by Representative Kahn and the Deputy Secretary of State's office.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I looked at this, I was surprised to see all this election language in a higher education and workforce development bill. As a former member of the Government Operations Committee and State Government Finance, it's more that I expect those provisions to be there. And so what I've done is this amendment deletes all those provisions. The appropriate place for these things are in State Government Finance or the GovOps bill.
Well, members, we had a full hearing on it, and the reason it's here is because it deals with our post-secondary institutions and students voting, so that's why it's in the bill. Any other questions on it?
Mr. Chair, with your feeling that way, I'm guessing my bill won't, or my amendment won't pass. I will ask for a roll call, but I will say that this opens the bill up to a lot of new possibilities, and I look forward to that later on.
Well, there's a lot of possibilities. There's a wild frontier out there for this. So. Kirk will take the roll. Votes no.
Anderson.
Aye.
Atkins.
No.
Lyon.
No.
Reiner. No. Clark. Detmer.
Yes.
Downey.
Yes.
Eastman.
Aye.
Hunter.
Aye.
Hodge.
No.
Mahoney.
No.
McFarland.
Aye.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
Yes.
Norton. Obermuller.
No.
Poppy.
No.
Delton.
No.
Eleven to seven, the motion does not prevail. Representative Mahoney, A8, I think.
A7?
Do you have an A8 too?
Under A7.
I don't know if I have
the A7 amendment. Members, do you have the A7 amendment? Okay, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is the prevailing wage compliance amendment. This clarifies and makes uniform the procedures for reporting prevailing wage. It does not expand the act. It just makes it more consistent across the board. This amendment comes out of the legislative auditor's report and deals with two of the recommendations. The legislature should make primary agencies contract agencies primarily responsible for enforcing the state prevailing wage law. The Department of Labor and Industry should provide training and technical assistance. And the other one was the legislature should require contractors working on state-funded projects to submit certified payroll records to contracting agencies, both of which the Department of MnDOT already does. Page 1, MnDOT already does. Page 1, starting on line 12, that is the requiring a certified report with respect to all wages and benefits. It's the exact language coming out of MnDOT. Page 2, where you see throughout on page 2, it changes, say on line 2.8, it deletes 177.35 and changes it to 177.44. That was a drafting error from a couple of years ago or last year. I can't remember which. It's been told to me, but my memory is fading.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. And that cleans that up. On page 3, the definition of fringe benefits. This is pretty much just taken right out of federal law. It clarifies it and makes it less likely to. I'm just trying to cut the lawyers out, what I'm trying to do, Mr. Chair and committee members. Less lawsuits on what it really means for a fringe benefit. I can make friends around here all the time. And then that starts the fringe benefit definition starts at 3.10 and goes to 3.20. Starting at 3.23,
is a, what we're trying to do is make it so if on a particular job you may have a general contractor and you'll have subs and employees of subs. And what the general contractor wants to be sure here is that if the subcontractor is bad with prevailing wage with their employees, that doesn't count against the general contractor. And the reason for that is on is subdivision 6A, because there's a penalty, much like we have with OSHA and minimum wage and overtime wage. It's kind of taken out of that matrix where the commissioner would have the ability to consider the size of the company, the type of infraction. And what this does is this is about the only part of the bill that the department was not very comfortable with. The rest of it they're relatively comfortable with. This commissioner shall require, how should I say this? If an employee is found in violation, they can there's an investigation. They can be ordered to make the employees whole. If there's repeated violations, and that's where the general contractor was concerned, if there's repeated violations more than two in 24 months, there is a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for each violation for each employee. So it starts to add up if there's five or six people on a work crew. And that's why the general contractors wanted the section on page 3. On page 4 at the top, where it says contract requirements, are starting at 4.4. What this does is that says the political subdivision. So if the city of St. Paul has a contract out there and it fails to put in the documentation that it is a prevailing wage job and the certified wage requirements are required, that they could be held liable for the penalty, not the contractor, because the contractor bid the job according to the documents handed to them. So we're just trying to put some pressure on the city or on the political subdivision. If we're going to do it for one, we should do it for everyone. Members, that's pretty much the bill. I have some very high-priced attorneys here that are willing to testify if there's questions that I can't handle. So,
is there anybody from the department here that wants to talk from the Department of Labor and Industry? Okay, Representative Gotham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know where exactly to put it, Representative Mahoney, but shouldn't there be some provision in this bill to make sure that the contractor has to inform any subs that this is a prevailing wage job? Because if that information fails to get to a subcontractor, he could be in deep trouble because of that omission. So would you be open to a verbal amendment wherever the staff says we should put it to make sure that that's one of the requirements of the contractor?
Mr.
Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I'm very comfortable with putting some requirement for the general contractor. Unless you are pretty sure where we could put it in verbally, I'm more than comfortable. I'm going to guess we're going to be back tomorrow, having staff work on it tonight and before we come back tomorrow and put it in.
That would be very acceptable.
Mr. Chair, what do you...
Now you're acting like me. I've oversacked the... I guess
voted.
That's a bad choice of words, Representative Don, given today. Are you suggesting we lay this aside for now and then have staff do that or vote on this now and then fix it up tomorrow?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Like I said, I had a couple of very well-paid attorneys in the audience, and I could just send them off to craft that while and spare our staff. And then all we'd have to do is have staff look at it to make sure there's no unintended consequences.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wouldn't be comfortable voting on this at this point. I'm troubled by the prevailing wage statute as it currently exists and the kind of net increase to state-funded projects that I don't think many people are even aware occurs. But, for example, on a heavy highway project, I am told that anywhere from 5 to 8% increase in the cost of that job based on prevailing wage. So the $600 million that we just passed in the transportation stimulus authorization, do the math, 30 to $60 million of that is probably a premium that we're paying on prevailing wage. And now we just added a whole boatload of benefit categories in here, and there's other provisions about the rate of contribution. I think this is more complicated than it looks and worth a deeper look relative to what this might do to increasing the prevailing wage cost on state government jobs. So I'd welcome hearing from the attorneys and having some further discussion or laying this over and having a more detailed review of it. But
Representative Downey, while you and I don't hold the same opinion of prevailing wage and its cost to the state, I think that in the long run it saves money myself. But given the fact that it is pretty complicated, and I feel uncomfortable because there's nobody here from Dolly, although I should put this on the bill just because of that. I will respect your wishes on this one, Representative Mahoney, and we'll
bring it back tomorrow morning.
Bring it back tomorrow morning, I guess, with some, and I hope somebody says something to Dolly about not being here, but maybe we should just do it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
will somebody from Deed tell him we did it, and then we'll see what, just to get the rumor going, call somebody on a phone or something. Can we lay it over for the time being and address the Gunther thing, and let's take it up in the morning. It is a little more...
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair, I'm very comfortable with that, whichever the chair chooses to do or the role of the committee. I do want you to know, I've been assured that Deed has been, not Deed, but Dolly has been involved every step of the way, and the place of disagreement is Subdivision 6, or Section 6. So you might want to...
Okay.
That's the place where you're going to... There's some arguments there. And that's how they... the penalty phase. That's a little stronger than they wanted it.
We'll
tomorrow we can deal with it.
And we'll take it up tomorrow. Representative Mahoney, then, do you have the 08? The A8, excuse me. Dealing with the petrol fund.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Members, if you look in the appropriation, the Department of Employment and Economic Development gets the some of that petrol fund money for the for some brownfield cleanups and that. So, and I to the tune of about seven, I believe, million. So, Representative Mahoney, what does this do quickly?
Mr. Chair, when they cleaned up a location in my district, it was a shingle manufacturer. They found hardened tar. And because it was hardened tar, they couldn't use the petrol fund to clean it up. This just expands it. They've had the department and all parties that have is part of it have a question to it, have agreed that this is decent language, and it just makes it available to clean up hardened petrochemicals.
Any comment from Deed at all on this? Come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm with Deed. We hadn't seen this amendment until today, but I was assured by the people representing the City of St. Paul that the definition of the petroleum components here that are involved in this amendment do accord with the national standards on petroleum contamination, and also that I think that the Petroleum Association, Mr. Krogman, I believe, thinks that this is appropriate as well. So I haven't had a chance to talk with our staff back in the office since I've seen this tonight, Mr. Chairman, But as far as we can tell, it looks like a reasonable definition that we could work with.
Thank you, Mr. Lump. Representative Anderson.
Well, Representative, Mr. Chair, this is a question from Mahoney.
Representative Mahoney, go ahead.
Okay. Are we talking about what Representative Scalzi had issues with the asphalt having tar in it and then it leaking into lakes? Is this what we're talking about?
Or? Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, no, this was tar that had been there for 40 to 50 years and had, actually it was the tar that you would use on a shingle and it hardened into a rock. Now, leaking into water tables, no, that never came into that as far as I know of. Now, I could bring down the Ms. Haney, who spent a little bit more time on it in the negotiations and may have a little bit better perspective from the Port Authority's view.
Representative Anderson, I think it's just fancy use, you know, of that special fund money that comes to the department that's given to us by Commerce for cleanup sites for economic development purposes to clean them up, and it just expands these substances, as Mr. Lofter says, they're compatible with what the federal government uses. So, go ahead.
Representative Mahoney, I will be curious to know if this would apply to Scalzi's situation, and then if that is the case, if we have an inventory of how much is out there and what kind of demand that was placed on the petrol fund. Just so we have a better picture overall of what we're talking about for cleanup, if we're going to be putting this under this category versus under environment finance, you see what I'm kind of getting at?
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of what Representative Scalzi has a problem, but I certainly can find out and see if we can get you an answer for that.
That would be great.
Mr. Loftus, can you answer any of the questions on that?
Mr. Chairman, I cannot. I will talk with the staff about this. And
Ms. Haney, do you want to come forward on that question? Welcome to the committee and identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kathy Haney, and my client is the St. Paul Port Authority. I should have worked sooner with BEAD on this amendment, and I apologize, but I did work with the Department of Commerce, the folks that run the petrol fund, as well as Mr. Krogman, who represents the petroleum marketers, and their concern was to make sure that it was crafted very narrowly so it wouldn't impact any of the definitions within the Department of Commerce use of the petrol fund. So that gave me a fair amount of comfort that we're really, maybe that's not a good thing. I don't know Representative Scalzi's situation, but it really, they did not feel that it would impact any other kinds of projects other than this tar-like substance that we all thought was, you know, a good use of petrol fund dollars because we thought it came from petroleum. So, okay.
Representative Anderson?
If you could maybe talk to Representative Scalzi, and I apologize, I don't remember all the details, but it's something, it's a sealant that's used on asphalt, and apparently they're finding now that it washes off into lakes, and they found a big sludge of it in one of the lakes, and I think in a district, and the city wound up spending like $10 million to clean it up, and right now we're, I think, in environment finance, we're trying to provide funding through that route to clean it up. So.
Okay, no further questions then. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Obermueller, the 435 amendment that I believe members have. Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an amendment to the unemployment insurance portion of the bill. And it's a bulk of the information on the things that we actually talked about a little bit in committee, but then we ran out of time that day, so we laid the bill over. But I'll just walk through the three or four things that it does here. The first is it puts the language back in about having an attorney sign off on settlements, compromises of fees or bills that are owed by employers. We did, with consultation with Mr. Nelson from the department, did move that number up to 10,000 to make sure we're not getting an attorney involved when there's just a minor amount at stake. But if we're going to compromise $10,000, we want an attorney to decide whether that's a good settlement or not good settlement. The second section that where it's page 104 on line 1.8 is the issue that we talked about a little bit earlier in committee, where if you have to pay back, you don't pay back your fees as an employee, You can be stuck with attorney's fees and costs and so forth if the department has to sue you to get those back. And what this does is it changes it to that a normal employee who hasn't committed fraud or anything like that wouldn't be subject to those fees. They would still owe the money back if they would owe the money back, and they wouldn't get stuck additionally with fees on top of it. The line 1.10, where page 118 changed, that makes sure that employees can still file appeals by paper and not have to use the electronic method. Lines 1.11 through 1.18 are two little changes that affect how we take care of the actual hearings that take place. The first tells the unemployment law judge to tell the applicant or the employee in most cases that they have the right to request documents and witnesses be subpoenaed at the hearing and ask for the hearing to be continued. I understand that the department is probably already doing this in most cases. I want to make sure it's clear. And the second section just says that you can bring in, you know, a paper witness instead of a real witness to, you know, a live witness, I guess, to have some testimony put in, but subject to the right of challenging the testimony that's written down there. And the last section, starting on 1.19, is just a little tweak that deals with how, when you try to appeal these cases to the Court of Appeals, the department's always been great about giving the record, which is the documents and the testimony, to the person that's asking for it, but the law actually didn't allow them to do that if the person had misplaced the record or didn't have the filed copies. This allows them, basically during the time of appeal or just prior to filing the appeal, to get a copy of the record in order to present their defense or their prosecution case at the Court of Appeals level.
Any comments from the department? If not, then all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Downey, Representative Obermueller, the 0436 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an amount.
It's just getting passed, don't know. But it seems pretty straightforward, so go ahead with it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is I'll move that 436 amendment, and this is an amendment that basically would tie the unemployment law judge wage to a percentage of what we pay our workers' compensation judges, which is also tied to a percentage of what we pay our district court judges. The current wage range that the ULJs, or the unemployment law judges, have range from about $49,500 to $73,000. And in that price range, it's difficult to get to recruit people who are going to be the judges for these unemployment law appeals that we want, the kind of people we want to do that. We've got good people in there now, but they're seasoned because they've got a lot of experience. But as we get new people coming in, the people who can be recruited for $49,000 are people just out of law school or people who are transitioning jobs that we're not able to attract, you know, the people who we really want to be those judges. And so what this would do is it would up the ULJ wage to about $85,800. Basically would tie it so that we would have it, you know, kind of in connected and lockstep with what the district court judges are making, which is about 25% more than what workers' comp judges make, and then tying this down. It would apply only to new hires going forward where they must have this new wage hike. The department would be able to determine, I guess, out of their own what to do with the current people that are there, many of whom are probably in that range that are close to that already.
Okay, the department want to comment on this at all? Mr. Nelson, do you want to comment on this particular one? Mr. Gustafson. Oh, Mr. Gustafson.
Hello, Mr. Chair. How are you?
Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, too. Craig Gustafson, the Director of the Appeals Operations Office in the UI program. The department does support...
Members, for those of you that don't know, he used to be one of our URIs. He was a pretty good guy.
Was.
Keep that record going right now.
Mr. Chair, what this would do is basically allow us to recruit a little better quality and caliber attorney to work in the unemployment law judge position. We've been having a hard time finding, top caliber people. And so basically what we end up doing to find, intelligent young lawyers to do this position, we have to recruit them straight out of law school. And so really to do this job the way it needs to be done, you need an experienced attorney with 5 to 10 years of experience. So That's what this would do. Currently, our judges top out at $73,000 a year, and that just does not compare favorably with comparable positions. Our workers' compensation judges currently make $114,000 a year, as do our Office of Administrative Hearing Judges. In Wisconsin, they pay their unemployment lodges up to $113,000 per year. In Iowa, $102,000 per year. So this would get us a little closer in the range with those comparable offices. I'd stand for any questions as well.
Any questions of Mr. Assistant or of the amendment? Okay, well then, Representative Norton had a question first, and then we'll go to you, Representative Downey, and then Representative Murphy. Representative Norton.
I think it's for the amendment, and perhaps Testifier could answer the question, and that is, I don't see a fiscal note on here, and so I'm wondering how this will be paid for if there's some internal funds.
It's out of the UI fund, and there are administrative fees in the UI fund.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This comes from our federal administrative grant, so it doesn't affect any of the state general fund or anything like that.
And Representative Downey.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. That answered one question. And then the other is, as we're talking about possible wage freezes, how does this, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Gustafson as compared to Representative Obermuller, but how would this fit in to that? Or is it somehow excluded? Is this a separate category of state employee or employee of the court that wouldn't fit under the executive branch agencies? Or how does this fit?
Mr. Gustafson, can you answer that one?
Well, as a statutory exception, I think it would trump any kind of wage freeze that the administration has in place currently.
The department supports the amendment.
That's right. Yeah.
Representative Obermiller, do you want to address it?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the issue is that one of the reasons I put in the July 1st, 2009 date as the new hires after that date. So to the extent there are freezes on not hiring new employees, it's not going to go into effect for those employees until after that freeze goes away. So it may be addressed by the fact that you wouldn't be hiring new employees as of that, you know. But once you do, then that's the amount that we're going to be paying them.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gustafson, what if this is the pensions then of these people? And then the new people will have a better pension than the people that have been serving for 20 years?
Well, I think the concept... That's a good Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the excellent question. I think what, as far as the pension goes, the concept would be that this new position of the unemployed, currently all our unemployment law judges are in the classification of a compensation attorney, and the new position would be the unemployment law judge. So the compensation attorney position, which tops out at $73,000, they would still be, you know, earning their state pension under the Minnesota State Retirement System. But you know, the new unemployment law judge retired after that under this would earn pension at the rate of pay that they're paid. So,
Representative Murphy, it happens all the time when pay increases happen too. I guess not to the extent that this is bumped up, but our judges, as an example, our regular district court judges had some pretty hefty increases. You may recall in the 90s where they surpassed the governor's salary. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gustafson, then do they go in the MSRS judges fund then? Pension fund?
Mr. Gustafson.
No, I think so. With the intent was that they would still be under the general employees fund in for the
MSRS,
retirement.
But under general.
The general plan, yeah.
We'll get a clarification for that.
Mr. Gustafson,
you can get us a clarification on that. We'll vote on the amendment and then maybe some language to specify that they're still under the regular MSRS pension fund and not the judge's compensation fund. Okay. Representative Eastland and then Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What has been the pattern, the wage pattern of wage increases over time here of this group? Are they negotiated salaries? Are they just something that get inflationary increases? Or what's been their history?
These employees are currently under the State Employees Commissioner's Plan. So when the Commissioner's Plan receives wage increases, the unemployment law judges or compensation attorneys in that class receive bumps as well.
Mr. Chair?
Uh-huh.
So what are the so what kind of increases have they had? What's been happening in the last four?
Well, I think to kind of track what the state bargaining units have received for increases over the last several years, that's been 2-3.5%. So the couple years ago they were topping out at 68,000-69,000, and now they're maxing out at 73,000. So it's been slow and steady.
Okay, no further questions, then all those in favor signify. Oh, excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Duffire, just clarify for me at this point, as I'm reading this language, it's talking about only the new hires. So the people who are currently hired, are they going to be paid less than the new hires?
Well, I think the concept was that this new position of unemployment law judge with the new salary could possibly be opened up to the incumbents as well.
I think the Representative Oldman-Mueller addressed that the state was in there so that the hiring freeze and that we started on the new fiscal year, but I believe if you read the language, that current law judges would also be able to be adjusted, or am I reading it wrong? Representative Overmuir.
Mr. Chair, the provision I've got here talks about how we recruit the next generation or the next attorneys in line that are going to be these unemployment law judges. There may well be unemployment law judges that are currently working there that the department or the UI folks will actually want to bump up to this new wage because that's they're worth keeping at that wage and they want to increase it. There may be others who are going to be at their current wage going forward, but we're not going to be. Hopefully, they're not going to be hiring a first-year law school student, a first-year student out of law school, at this new wage. They're going to be looking for that 5 to 10 year attorney that's going to fill in this spot. And the only way to recruit those folks is to get this new wage in place.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Murphy.
Just one more, Mr. Justin, when you're finding out that stuff about pensions, find out what percentage their salary goes to pensions.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I'll do that for you. We'll get you that information.
Okay, no further questions. I don't see any further comments from the audience or the department. If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Okay, we're going to go back to the Mahoney Amendment, and we have an amendment to the amendment that Representative Gunter has drafted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have accommodated Representative Mahoney, and I apologize for all the problems I caused. Ms. Newman will read the amendment in context of the bill. The other amendment, the amendment to the amendment, please.
Ms. Newman, Anita, do you want to?
Mr. Chair and members, a handwritten copy of this is actually being handed out. On the A7 amendment, the following changes will be made. On page 4, line 6, on page 4, line 4, after and, you'll insert all. On page 4, line 6, after contractor, insert and all subcontractors. And on page 4, line 9, after contractor, insert or subcontractor.
Okay, to the Gunter Amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails to the full amendment now. Any further questions on this full amendment? Not all those in favor, say. All those in favor then of the Mahoney A7 amendment as amended, say aye.
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 Oh, excuse me. Representative Anderson. Representative Valley.
Yeah, so we are on the full A7 amendment
as amended.
I guess you think, Mr. Chairman, a question for Representative Mahoney on page 3. The stricken text starting on 3.11 and ending on 3.12 for health through the economic benefit as compared to what the added tax that starts on 3.13 and ends on 3.20. On the one hand, that could just be a more precise listing. On the other, it could be an addition of additional categories of benefits that would go into the prevailing wage. Can you explain kind of the purpose of that section in the reporting bill?
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, the stricken language is the kind of confusing language that draws people into legal proceedings. The new language is taken directly out of federal statutes and makes it clearer. An example, under the old language, a contractor tried to charge to all of their employees the cost of CLA instructions for their contract attorney, and almost got away with it. Now, that wouldn't quite fly underneath the new language. The old language, it was worth a try anyhow for the contractor, I don't know, but and there are also there's a number of other examples of kind of not really appropriate deductions for prevailing wage deductions, such as whether it's a truck or it's mileage or hotel costs or meals or whatever. The new language just gives you the exact language out of federal statute.
Representative Downey.
For example, we've stricken health and welfare benefits and replaced it with medical or hospital care. Maybe I'm misreading this, and I guess if it's federal conformity, maybe that's just the way it is. But so are we paying for benefits in that largest number of workers, or does that get rolled into prevailing wage calculations, or is it the care that they actually receive? I mean, if somebody has a multi-million-dollar episode of care, does that get rolled in? And
Representative Donnie, I think the current prevailing wage law is clear about addressing that benefits are included in prevailing wage, and so I think
and Mr. Chair, I think if Representative Downey, if you're asking if I go out and I break my leg and that's covered underneath my health insurance, no, that wasn't covered to begin with. It's not covered under new language. That's the health and or hospital care is pretty much your health insurance.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on this one.
Okay. Roll call is being requested. Any further questions? If not, the clerk will take the roll. Rukavina votes yes.
Anderson. No. Atkins.
Aye.
Bly.
Yes.
Reiner.
No.
Clark.
Yes.
Detmer.
No.
Downey.
No.
Eastman.
No.
Gunther.
Yes.
Yes. Mahoney. Yes.
Farley.
Yes.
Murphy. Yes.
No. Hard to get out there.
I think he really wanted to vote yes, member.
Norton.
Like Murphy.
Norton. Overmuller.
Yes.
Hoppy.
Yes.
Members, the motion prevails 13-6. Representative Gunther on the Barber of the A9 amendment. And I think the A9 amendment is being passed off. Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, I have another amendment.
To this A9?
A12 amendment. Also, A9 amendment. Members, this is taking the Board of Barbers and separating them from the Board of Cosmetology. I plead guilty for merging the two. The reason I merged the two is because the Board of Cosmetology wasn't allowed to have a board at the time. They were spending close to $2 million a year for getting 1.5 inspectors to make sure the integrity of their occupation was upheld. And they had testing done through the Department of Commerce, and I didn't think that was a fair representation of their money. So we merged them with the barber's permission to make sure that they both had equal representation in this board, and they never did from day one get along with each other that I know of. I have had constant calls and complaints about it. The chairman had the same responses I've had. And finally, we got to the point that we decided it's time for a divorce and dissolution of the thing. There's no one group that is fault. I think it's just not doable. And I don't say one side is at blame and the other one is not, because I think they do, but they both are agreeable that the best thing we can do is to separate them. They both will have their own board. They both will have their own PO box eventually after July 1st when this thing comes up. They both will have their own money. And this is the decree of dissolution, A9, and divorce is actually A12, an amendment to the amendment. That's the one that separates the two forever and eliminates the language that put them together. So those are the problems we had, and please do me a big favor. So would I.
Is there child support in here at all? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the amendment? Come on down. And just identify yourself for the tape then.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Gina Sousa. I'm the director with the Board of Barber and Cosmetologist Examiners. So I'm just here to answer any questions, if there are any. That's what I'm here to do.
And so I think the language for the requested increase that you had is in the bill. The fee increase are here in the bill that's for the cosmetologist. And just a question to maybe staff or Representative Gunther then, is there a mechanism in here then for the barbers to increase if they have to? Any fees, Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and members, there is an amendment for some fee increases for the barbers, but we do not have a fiscal note on that yet. So there isn't in this amendment barber fee increases.
So the cosmetologist fees are in the bill.
That was in the governor's draft, and that's
governor's
in the bill.
And it's in the bill, but after the dissolution here, divorce, there isn't a mechanism. Well, I think we could take care of that if needed. I guess the amendment, I guess there's a Department of Finance is looking at some type of fiscal thing for us. We can look at. Maybe we'll have it tomorrow. Okay, thank you, Ms. Felston. Any questions, Representative Murphy?
Are they going to be co-located?
Representative Gunther, do you let the decision be made by finance or admin?
Mr. Chairman, talking to the barbers, they would like to be not in the same location, but they will be in the same location until July 1st, I believe, is the date. And we encourage them to talk together and to come up with anything that they could share, and they have found no common ground that I know of.
Mr. Chair, maybe we are rewarding that behavior.
Well,
enabler.
Representative Rukavina and members of the committee, this is not a board-driven initiative, and the board members themselves and the staff I don't believe, have any interest in actually separating. So, you know, the board in back in December of 2007, as three barbers and three cosmetologists and a public member, have voted to stay together. If you attend any of our board meetings, there is no actual disagreement, and no profession has ever been hurt by the other. So, again, this is not a board-driven initiative. But I think in regards to staffing and clarification, if this is a removal of the and the dissolution of the current board, and the barbers moving on to themselves, with the staffing, does that mean all staff remain with the cosmetology board and the barbers completely start over? They hire their own executive director, the executive director hires their own staff, because if that does result, based on the budgets, if I'm the director of either agency, you would not be able to sustain the amount of staff. Our staff are not divided into, you know, staff member, you know, Gina is a barber employee and staff member Billy is a cosmetology employee. It's all a proportionate of what the revenue is and the appropriations, which the current appropriation is $188 in barbering and $561 in cosmetology. And those fees you were talking about a couple minutes ago is a $90,000 base budget increase into the cosmetology board. So those are all cosmetology-generated revenue.
And we, members, we don't touch that.
Yes.
Your fee request and increase. And I think the amendment allows the executive branch of government to determine the location. Yeah. And the amendment also then, Ms. Newman says, provides for the staff transfer. And so, any further questions? Representative Downey. Oh, excuse me, Representative Murphy, were you done?
No, Representative
Murphy, excuse me.
My understanding was that one of the things that was hard for people to understand was that you were paying, you were generating more money than was being given to the budget for the, especially cosmetology. And that's not changing, is it?
No.
Mr. Chairman, and so how are you going to get over, if we do this, you're still going to have that problem, so how are you going to get over that?
Representative Rukavina and members of the committee, based on even the increase to cosmetology, there will likely be layoffs. There's going to be, we pretty much scraped right now to the bottom of the barrel with all administrative costs. It's, you know, it all presumes what the unions do if they freeze their wages or not. But yes, you are right. The cosmetologists bring in approximately $1.3 million and will now be appropriated with the $90,000, approximately $551,000 of the $1.3 million generated.
Representative Murphy and members, that was always the case. As Representative Gunter alluded to earlier, when they were at the Department of Commerce, they were basically a cash cow over there that had 1.5 inspectors and raised quite a bit of money, and very little of it was used. There are other boards, the Board of Electricity, I don't know if that's still the case, Representative Mahoney, where certain union fees or whatever assessments are also, some of it gets deposited in the general fund. I know in the past it did, but I'm not aware of any currently.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, with due respect to the last question, the board, particularly the cosmetology board, it has only been pulled out for a bit over 3 years, would like additional staff. I've been here, you know, 2 years in a row, actually 3 years now, indicating the needs for additional staff. So I think even if the board separate, if presumably I'm the director of one of the agencies, you will see me back here again indicating to the committee why we need additional funds appropriated to the agency. And I think the barbers will be the same way as well, that they will need an additional higher appropriation than what they currently have of $188.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the testifier, you're saying that the current board, or the members, don't support this legislation of the separation. So can you tell me, are you hearing from a lot of the cosmetologists and the barbers, or maybe Representative Gunther can answer that where's the disagreement coming from? Are you hearing from a lot of people, or just a few people who are being very loud and really being or aggravating you and others?
Representative Rukavina and members of the committee there, at our board meetings, we've had one individual in regards to phone calls to our offices complaining about the merger. No, but Representative Rukavina and others may have other phone calls they're receiving.
Representative Murphy, I apologize. I didn't know you still had another question. Representative Murphy, and then Representative Donnie.
Mr. Chairman, I have more of a statement, and I think they've come a long way in the years from the very night that it happened publicly. And I think a lot of good has happened in the 3 years that the merger has taken place. And I think dissolutions are always something that we should consider very, very carefully, and it shouldn't be sometimes you need some waiting periods, and sometimes you need some counseling, and I think that it certainly should be very well thought out before it happens.
Well,
maybe we could have had a little more preparation too. And
thank God the children are grown.
Sometimes guidance from the family helps too.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, Representative Gunther, are any of these problems, which are hard to put a finger on, compromising the effectiveness of licensure or the safety of customers at all? Is this an effectiveness thing here, or is it just a board-level dispute?
Representative Gunther, do you want to answer that?
I certainly will attempt to. In the board, it represents approximately, and you correct me if I'm wrong, which I'm sure you will, there's 36,000 cosmetologists, is that correct?
Approximately.
And there's approximately 6,000 barbers. The reason that we set up the board the way it was an equal number of barbers and an equal number of cosmetologists, was simply we didn't want the barbers overrun by 36,000 cosmetologists. And remember, the group that had the board to begin with were the barbers. The barbers were the only reason the cosmetologists got to be part of this board. So we thought everything was fine. They were going to even share inspectors. However, the only inspector the barbers had didn't like it. And I think right now, how many cosmetology inspectors do you have presently?
Representative Rukavina and Representative Gunther, currently there's three inspectors that are inspecting all establishments on individualized inspection processes. So this one of the new systems we built is you do not go into a barbershop and inspect them off a cosmetology style inspection report. It is tailored specifically to a barbershop and vice versa. And that is all a computerized system that I believe will disintegrate for the barbers in this separation.
Ms. South, there's only three inspectors for the entire?
Currently, with the hiring, Mr. Chair, we had to bring one of our four inspectors into the office due to the hiring freeze right now to assist with licensing to ensure we're balancing both.
And how many inspectors were there with the barber board when it was just the barber board?
Mr. Chairman, just one.
No, Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman and members, the barbers were inspected at least on a biannual basis.
Oh, yeah, that's correct.
And the cosmetologists weren't inspected for sometimes 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that we brought the two together to make a board out of them so that we could have more inspectors for the cosmetologists.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to make sure the integrity of their profession was
upheld. And that was the overwhelming reason why I worked on it at all. However, for some reason, they never got along. And she said she never has any complaints. I'm sorry, before she got there, there was a lot of them. And you talk to Representative Mulry, every time he threatened to tell me that three or four barbers from his district are going to come get me, which I really wasn't too concerned about. But
look at your hair, Representative.
I tell you, it is not the Peace in the Valley type thing that is being reflected here. And they should be happy. The cosmetologists have their own board. They're going to get some more of their money, which I thought was grossly unfair. The barbers are happy with this move. They're looking forward to taking care of themselves and having their own, collecting their own money beginning July. The Department of Admin is going to separate the funds in an amicable way. And I think in order to have peace in the valley and let me sleep a little better every week, I just want to have this amendment passed. Thank you.
Representative Donnie, final say again.
Does this change cost the state any more than it does currently? I'll ask the...
No, their fees and so...
Representative Rukovina, I would recommend, some sort of one-time small appropriation, in particular to the barber board, if it is split, to get their feet on the ground, to get them started.
We can address that as we discuss.
And for the committee, I would just like to also rest assured that it's not that we're not doing inspections in the last approximately 10 months when we've implemented a new licensing system and had to have the inspectors come in-house to help out a little bit. We've done over 2,400 inspections. So it's not that they're not getting done. And those are all available online.
No further questions then. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Gunther, A-12 amendment.
Let me find it here. A-12? You got the A-12? Okay, Mr. Chairman, this was being part of the Green Jobs Task Force. A-12? Oh, A-12. Okay, that was part of the A-9 amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I think it takes the language out of the bill so that this can happen.
There is some language in the bill for a study on the marriage counseling part of the bill, and now the marriage counseling has turned into the divorce. So that would delete the language that's currently in the bill. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. And now, Representative Gunther on the 0439 amendment dealing with an appropriation from the deed that I think currently is going on from the Commerce dealing with deed doing some multi-agency promotion and collaboration on green enterprise and green economy projects. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Being passed around.
The 0439 amendment is from the Green Jobs Task Force. It was heard from businesses and entrepreneurs about the lengthy and confusing process in place for setting new and expanding current businesses in Minnesota. The Green Enterprise Assistance at Deed will make it easier for entrepreneurs and existing businesses to go through the web of the state agencies to more effectively create and keep jobs in Minnesota. The Green Jobs Enterprise Assistance merely clarifies in statute an existing interagency collaborative and requires Deed to identify a go-to person to lead this continued cooperation. It does not create any new authority or agency. It gives a name to an effort and a business that a business can understand. Deed has been working closely with the Green Enterprise Assistance and ensures the efficacy of the alignment. This is a one-stop shop to assist businesses in state licenses, permits, and grant processes to support Minnesota businesses to create and retain jobs throughout the state, to provide an environment where the businesses can thrive and job creation and retention is bolstered. The amendment is for a green enterprise assistance will be paid for with the remaining balance, the Green Job Task Force appropriation from 2008. So they have approximately $100,000 left, and that will cover the cost.
Anybody from Deed want to comment on it? Mr. Rocker, come on up.
Mr. Chairman, Mark Loftus from Deed. As you know, this is not a governor's initiative. However, we have been communicating with Representative Kalin and our associates and our colleagues at the other agencies about this program. We have had the Department of Commerce has started an initiative last year called, the acronym is CECON. It stands for Clean Energy Commercialization Opportunities Network, and it's a kind of a prototype for this, which, as we see, formalizes the relationship between the agencies and the expectation that we will work together. There are a lot of, as we've discussed in the committee before, there are many green technology businesses that we want to work with as effectively as possible, and as we see it, this would give a formal structure. I don't know how all the other agencies see this bill. I assume they would. I guess I shouldn't assume anything, I guess, Mr. Chairman, but I would hope. I would hope that they would work through any differences that they may have with particular language on the bill. And
okay, Mr. Office, do you know the answer to this question? If this was some money that was canceling, is finance booking the cancellation in the? And so is this going to cost the committee $100,000 ongoing, or is it going to cost us money? Is there somebody? You don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer.
And I don't know the answer, and finance doesn't know the answer, so let's just set this one aside till tomorrow and rep some concerts. How about the last amendment for the evening, Representative Norton? Has a handwritten amendment that says page 47, line 21, this appropriation may also be used in Rochester. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, for the last 2 years, we had a very tiny amendment to this FlyTrack funds for Rochester because we had a large and new immigrant population that I felt this would benefit. So we tried a $50,000 2 years ago and $80,000 last year. It's been wildly successful. They've placed, I think this year already, 74 workers. Average income is around $9 or $10 an hour. They've gotten people off MFIP. Last year it was 14 people off MFIP. This year it's similar. It's been very, very successful. Because there isn't money this year in an amount that I was comfortable in, after talking with LifeTrack, comfortable in asking for specific dollar amount. In working with them this afternoon, they agreed that we put this language in if during negotiations with the Senate, which has a slightly larger appropriation, this would allow them, should more money become available, if they so chose, to continue their relationship with Rochester, but it doesn't mandate anything. And they were comfortable with this language, and I would like to at least keep the door open for ended up being a really wonderful workforce program down in our area.
Okay. Members, there was a little nick in the, if you look at the $50,000, the governor cut that, I think $25,000 general fund money, and the workforce money is the base that Representative Norton had put some little, a little amount on top of that. So you're just working right within this money that can also be used in Rochester.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, but it doesn't mandate anything. It allows LifeTrack.
So there's no cost. And
right, no financial.
LifeTrack makes the decision.
Yes, they do, and they're fine with it.
Okay. Any questions then? not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. And members, we will then adjourn until 10:30, room 5. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.